The Romance of Mystery, Book 2. Written and read by Fresny, or given that this is a medieval romance, as I should be pronouncing it, Hren. Fandom, Sherlock BBC, The Romance of Silence, and Yavan, The Knight with the Lion. Pairings, Sherlock and John, Silence and Lunette, Nature and Nurture, but I've been pairing them since I read The Romance of Silence years ago. Rating, NC-17, warnings for Omegaverse, and all that implies, so the kink trifecta of DubCon, Nodding, and Empreg, as well as being a ridiculous medieval fusion. Chapter 1. The subject of another lay I shall now tell. It concerns Sherlock Lackland, who was born a prince and the seventh son of the king of Logris, and relates how he came to take Gero Valde Fructus as his motto. Now, around the time of Sherlock's birth, it was widely thought that there was some shame in being an Omega of male form, but they did not have the false idea that we do now, which this lay will also explain and set the story right. Now, it was understood then, as it is now, that women are by their humors cool, while men are by their humors hot. So it were best when the moistness of an Omega were combined in woman shape, that their humors might be balanced to a calm, phlegmatic humor, that they might keep from the sin of coupling outside of bond. Likewise, it were best to set the dryness of an alpha in male form for a choleric manner as suits the striving required in the field of battle. If a woman were an alpha, it was understood that the dry and cool led to black biliousness and a melancholy humor, which made them quite disruptive and fall into divisive behavior. While a man who was an Omega, he burned far too amorous with his sanguine nature and was easily led to sinful coupling outside of bond. For the king of Logris, this was of no concern. The line of that king had cast forth from as long as history was recorded an unbroken line of alpha men. Now the king and queen of that kingdom were quite proud of the six sons they'd cast, with history as their guide, in expectation of presentation, they gave their children alpha names at birth, rather than give a milk name to be changed at presentation. The firstborn was named Grenud, which in the French means great knot. All the bells on the cathedral rang when he was born, but were nothing to when he alpha presented and was crown prince made. Their second son was named Snaid Mor, which meant great knot in air. As he was the second, the Duchy of Clarence was he given at birth. The third they named Magna Notum, which means the same thing in the Latin, and granted the county of Magnans. The fourth and fifth were named Certus Claustrum and Magna Clavis, which means sure lock and great key in the Latin, and were granted baronies each in Cantia. The sixth was named Sure Assure, which means certain lock in the French, and was granted a barony in Alfric. king and queen went to the court of Cambernic to celebrate the presentation of his heir, who, though an Omega man and but 12 years old, already had brought great renown to the court of Cambernic, having slain a dragon when he was but 3, and when he was but 9, gone on a quest to bring his mother an apple of the Hesperides to cure her sickness. While many in sons the king and queen were, and though young, those presented were already renown for their knots. But no other renown had they brought. So though the king and queen came with gifts, in the queen's heart curled the venomous snake of spite. So at the feast, in great display, with spite writhing in her heart, the queen of Logris said in a loud voice, "I am much surprised that you celebrate the presentation of your heir as an Omega man, for it is well known that for a boy to present as an Omega, it is sure proof that his mother lay with a demon just after being bred, and so the child is but half his father's, and the other half a demon's." Now before this time, this was not well known, nor in fact believed. For although it is often said these days, it is not true. And before this thrice-cursed queen said it, this false thing was never said. But as she did say it, so it was then believed. And the Omegas in the land greatly hated the queen of Logris for making their lot more difficult. The king of Cambernic came to doubt his queen and kept her quite locked up, while he set aside his heir until a second child could be bred and an alpha proved. So it was with the snake of spite, well satisfied in her heart. The king and queen returned to Logris, where the queen was delivered of another boy, who they named Sherlock, which in the local tongue meant sure luck. As there was no land or title left to bestow, he was Sherlock Lackland. And as his bequest was given a collar of gold enriched with gems, and 4 bracelets, that he might have funds to pay a dower settlement, and thus have land settled on him. Now nature, listening at the feast in Cambernic, decided that in making Sherlock, she'd carefully do her work. She outdid herself in every way. His skin she made pale as bleached linen. Of his hair she spun silk into locks of a curling raven's black, and of his eyes emerald set with silver she cast. His face and body she shaped to perfection. Not content with that, she put great work to the shaping of his mind, which she poured full of curiosity, and also filled with sanguine impatience, as nature was not tempted to create perfection. Still yet, she granted him grace, an inborn skill at music, should nurture chance to teach him. There was one more gift that she gave, but that was not made apparent until later. Now, as Sherlock was but their 7th son, and yet a prince, his parents set him up with a household within the court, and left him in neglect to run quite wild. If, in his antics, he was over-spirited, that was laid down to an alpha's choleric nature being early felt. As he was an alpha prince to be, when he made cutting observations with his unceasing mind, people smiled to his face, while calling him an unnatural boy when his back was turned, thinking he'd not observe it. This thinking was quite false, but Sherlock told himself that it mattered not, as he was an alpha prince to be, and kept to his hungry observation. Now, his elder brothers but one followed their parents' neglectful suit, as their twofold joys was to contend in ever greater rutting, to prove their names true, and strive against each other for improved position. That one, who though Magnanotum was he christened, came to later fame with the name of Mycroft, by which name he had the titles of King of the Ostrogoths, Roman Consul, and Caesar of Rome in the West besides, all of which were gained by his great craft, as nature had taken even greater care with his mind than Sherlock, if not putting as much art in his appearance. So as that is how he is known to history, this story will also call him Mycroft. His interest in Sherlock was piqued when hearing of some complaints through some agents that even while youthful Mycroft possessed, he heard Sherlock's young piping voice in observation of an old widowed archer, but recently discharged from service, to care for his child. Mycroft looked upon his sibling as if for the first time, and paused to correct his error. "Children, my dear boy, children." Sherlock looked back upon the archer, and in being instructed, saw what his elder brother saw, and laughed that there was another, and with even greater observation. From then, Mycroft applied some nurture to the direction of Sherlock's studies, for it was he who gave his brother a copy of the Book of the Composition of Alchemy. The reading of this book created hunger, were it most satisfied. Before that day, although Sherlock could observe the surface of things, never would he have imagined the greater mystery all around him. So when he was but 9, Sherlock declared himself devoted to the great work of alchemy, whose goal is to burn the dross away and leave what is pure. So he engaged his study. However, the next time Sherlock chanced to offend a lord with cutting words, Mycroft waited for him, saying, "Now that you love your studies, you have aught to lose. So as you like to sharpen your wits, practice reasons, that when you speak so, I should let you keep your books, or else then cultivate better behavior, lest what I've given I take away." So it was then that Sherlock learned that caring was no advantage. Now, on reaching the age of 13, the king and queen at last turned their attentions to their youngest son. They were eager for his presentation, that they might throw a feast for it, and invite all the kings and queens to their court, and celebrate their many alpha sons. Widowed Omegas in heat were brought before him, that he might present, after which they planned to find him a suitable Omega heiress, with at least a county, so that he might have land settled on him by way of bonding. Indifferent he was to each of the widowed Omegas, although they cried out for surcease in their heat. Instead, he put his mind to the great work. He studied the ways the perfection may be achieved, and he'd no patience with less. So it was and is that alchemists study to purify dross metals into noble gold. It is not for greed, but for the purification this brings. Mortal flesh they sought and seek to purify, and so redeem flesh's ills, always striving for spiritual ennoblement through inner revelation, that mere transport may be cast off. The philosophers call this gnosis, and theologians call revelation by her name, which is Sophia, although that too is a veil to her true name. Following the alchemist Jabir's example, Sherlock was careful to do more than work on esoteric proofs, but made practical works and experiments that he might achieve a degree of mastery. Dedicated as he was, Sherlock declared that he had no wish to bond, nor breed, or rot, and never would. Rather, he would be a student of mystery, and yoke himself to the great work. Now, as he was a prince, this would not do. But Mycroft counseled his parents that they had but to wait, and nature would take its course, the wisdom of which they agreed and set to their waiting. Now, nature, standing by, agreed that she would take her own course, and decided it was time for the gift she'd given at birth to bloom. Sherlock fell first into a sickness of the bowels, and then to a sanguine sickness that with rising warmth drove him to his bed within his teeming household. There, with all his attendants standing by, he cried out, for what he knew not, as his entrance wept with an Omega's prima materia, which is to say, the primal matter of heat. The king and queen were quickly summoned, and the queen, weeping, ran back out on seeing her son thus presented, while the king looked coldly on, and declared that at least they had not settled lands on him, while purely bred sons went wanting. When desire had done with scourging Sherlock, for the first of many heats that fall into an Omega's life, he fell into melancholy. By his studies, he knew as an Omega it would be doubly hard to achieve his aims. And Omega's sanguine nature was pure dross of body and all appetite. Furthermore, although no ancient scholar wrote that an Omega man was of demonic birth, now having experienced desire's scourge, he entertained the possibility. Further, Omegas were of Eve, who caused the fall. Yet, Sherlock reasoned, for nature had crafted well his mind. Eve ate of the apple for curiosity's sake, that she might know, and he could not fault her for it. While Adam, an alpha, ate of the apple because it was fair, which was a far less noble reason. So by logic he reasoned that Omegas were naturally bent to knowledge, and he should take solace that a task that was doubly hard was doubly sweet. Knowing that he faced at least a 9 in difficulty, he comforted himself. So he emerged from his rooms and faced the court with his new status. Even with his wits, he could not have expected what he found. The clothes that he'd always worn, he was made to change, as he must dress as an Omega, according to ancient sumptuary law. The things that he liked to do, he was told to set aside. When an alpha prince he'd been thought to be, he'd been allowed much wild behavior. Now he was ever enjoined to modesty and chaste action, which for most is part of their daily upbringing, as there is no way to know what fate may hold. But for Sherlock, he'd always been urged to an alpha's part. Now modesty, on being brought to see Sherlock by nature, took one look and turned quite around and left the room. While chaste action had long studied with Sherlock in his rooms, considered the great work her most redoubtable weapon, and had no concerns in Sherlock's behavior. Chaste action is, and was, a beta. In the court, the kindest whispers now to his face were that he'd been poorly named, for no Sherlock would he be, but a sanguine lock that was sure to open for any key. While others contended that he was well named, for he was a surety. While others, thinking on his powers of observation, spoke quite openly how it must be true that Omega men came about only when their mothers, in wanton coupling, were jointly bred by a man and a demon. At best, it was said, the demon may have worn the king's face, but by the prong of the demon's staff, the queen ought to have known what cleaved her. In her shame, the queen withdrew to a nunnery of the Clares, and as it was her own spiteful words that had condemned her thus, she took a vow of silence ever after. The king, quite furious at the whispers his final son had brought, sent melancholy Sherlock to a remote castle in Magnance that was peopled with only betas. Here there were no books or paper, but a stone-faced lady beta, who, as the king's own bastard sister, set about teaching Sherlock embroidery. He raged within the estate walls, but poor behavior only summoned knowing nods, that this confirmed his demon birth. This made him rage all the more, and loudly threatened to run away into the nearby forest of Broceliande. The lady beta would then always reply that on the road he would have but one way to support himself, and that was on his back, which might please his sanguine blood, but would be a sure ruin of him. Quiet then he grew, and withdrew to think in his tower, where his chambers were kept. In that time, Sherlock had only three comforts. The first was a mixed comfort. A message came from Mycroft, and with that messenger was a chest full of learned works, and tools of alchemy, too. This messenger instructed the Lady Beta that she might do better in keeping Sherlock in check, and setting him to the lessons that Omega must learn. Had she these items with which to bargain for that good behavior? For Sherlock, there was a letter that enjoined him to take opportunity of this time of study, and consider himself like to the Omega nuns at the convent of the Magdalene in Broceliande, which daily devoted themselves to the study of the great mystery, with their library vast. But unlike the nuns, he'd one day emerge, when Mycroft had had time to cajole their father, the king, to a better temper. This was not the last letter. Many more were forthcoming, which was where the blessing was mixed. They each were full of unwanted advice, but they never came without at least one learned work. The letters said that Sherlock should take advantage of his lessons with the Lady Beta, that by hearing what not to do, learn in Omega's advantages, that he should cultivate the appearance of graciousness, that he should be quiet and watch everyone around him to his improved advantage, that he should be generous with his praise, that all would think well of him, that as an Omega he was in a position of greater opportunity for advancement, as a seventh-born Omega prince may marry a future king, but the reverse was never so, that he should cozen up to his aunt, the Lady Beta, as she had many good connections at the court of Logris and beyond. Sherlock tried. He tried to cozen up to the Lady Beta and smile grit teeth through instructions on his own evil, tempting nature. And then, like a boiling pot, he would explode. So it was during these lessons that he took to wandering in his mind the vast library of the convent of the Magdalene, that would be so filled with books that it would take up a dozen towers as the one in which he made his rooms. In his thoughts, the convent came to be a blessed alternative, where all were bent on the study of mystery. The more time he had to think on it, and now all he possessed was time, the more attractive this prospect became, of going to a place built to spin out the dross of an Omega's humors. He returned to the great work, with interruptions to learn unnecessary arts as they were pressed upon him. The second comfort was that he was taught the lute, and in being taught, found he liked it. So with his world in stagnation, and at war with himself, he took to playing often. The third comfort was that in the stable tending to the palfreys and jennets, that were now all the horses that Sherlock, as an Omega, was let to ride, there was a beta stable boy named Victor, much his age, who, rather than calling him Demon's Get, smiled on him and marveled at his observations. They were much in each other's company, the stable boy and the prince. Sherlock fell into voicing all his grievances to Victor's listening ears, or imitating those he'd known at court to Victor's laughter, or simply reeling out observations. In truth, Victor's great admiration was much tempered by desire, though they may not quicken. Betas can still feel, and nature had done her work well when she crafted Sherlock. There was naught but beauty in Sherlock's every aspect. Now desire daily flogged Victor, while temptation whispered in his ear as he sat next to his friend. Victor would at times deliberately turn so their flesh would touch, which would cause Sherlock to glance up and smile before continuing his discourse. Temptation told Victor that Sherlock would into heat fall, and from then yearn to couple with any staff near to hand. Temptation said that with no alpha staff available, a beta could take an alpha's place. And furthermore, as Sherlock's friend, Victor could easily be that beta. At night, Victor dreamed and groaned on this, and resolved to do it. So it was that when desire fell to scourging Sherlock with the iron-tipped flail of heat, he went to his only friend for comfort in the stables. No good thought spoke in Victor's ear, and desire gently flogged him on. So Victor made this offer. As you are suffering, and my staff cannot make you quicken, let me stroke inside you to fill you, and that may give you comfort. Now, Chaste Action as a beta was much embarrassed to be with Sherlock during his heat, and had not come with Sherlock when he went to find his friend. Greatly discomforted Sherlock was, and Victor was his friend. And as Sherlock knew, there had been a custom in Roman times for such, there could be nothing wrong in it. And desire thrashed him hard, so he could hardly think, but that he would take any opportunity for ease. So he agreed. Intemperate in action, Victor did not take Sherlock to a private place, but rather quickly bent him over a bale of hay and pushed his way in. Once he were seated, Victor moaned on the subject of Sherlock's moist, hot channel. Sherlock knew his mega humors were moist and hot. Largely he ignored Victor's words and sighed at the ease this action brought. He said, "You were right. This gives me some relief." He squirmed back upon Victor's shaft to give it better seat. But for that task, that staff was not well suited. Still, his motions were such as to set Victor further exclaiming on the desire that Sherlock engendered in him. And Victor gave Sherlock 20 more strokes ere they were discovered. Faced with having the staff with which he'd sinned removed for that sin, while Sherlock sat in shivering observation, Victor cried out, "The boy's demon nature made me do it, ere I'd never have made the offense." So Victor was set on the road with but 20 strokes of a crop, and Sherlock was locked away in his rooms in the castle's tower. Now, being found as they were, there was no way to keep this thing quiet. When the king learned of it, he was much wroth and raged that the demon boy should be mewed up forever. Well, all about the court, the word was spread that Prince Sherlock's virtue had been lost. And even with his princely birth, that no alpha should stoop to take him, for who would want a broken cup? His heat now ended. Sherlock sat at the only window in his tower, which faced out to the forest, and wondered at the shrinking of his world. He curled up in his tiny bed set in the wall and felt as if the walls closed in, crushing his expectations of himself entirely. With him sat Chaste Action, who was likewise in some despair, but urged comfort on Sherlock by whispering to him of the Spartan purity of study in the convent of the Magdalene. Now back at court, Mycroft said nothing in Sherlock's defense, but instead he went to visit their uncle, their maternal grandfather's bastard son, who was a beta cardinal at the papal court. Of this uncle, Mycroft requested papal dispensation for Sherlock to have 20 or so strokes in his time of heat from a beta staff, being as there'd be no breeding by it. He smiled and said if their uncle could not do it for family feeling, Mycroft offered him some assistance in certain matters, by which the standing of both would be much improved. When his uncle agreed, Mycroft requested that it were best that such a dispensation bear a date long before Sherlock's soon-to-be-expunged offense, that were no offense at all, being as it had already been forgiven. The dispensation in hand, Mycroft had some who owed him slight favors make much at court of their surprise that the dispensation was not widely known. Soon, those who liked to pretend it knowing, exclaimed they'd always known it, and then it was a short step for all to have always known it. And the cup of Sherlock's virtue was then, by this miracle, never broken. But the king was not assuaged in his choleric temper, and swore that the demon boy should never leave his tower, to which Mycroft smiled and bowed, and held his own counsel. Now Mycroft sent a messenger with a letter for Sherlock to explain the current turn of events in his lonely tower, and bearing also another box of books. Sherlock sneered at the letter and said to the empty air, "As I've no intent to bond or breed, the reinstatement of my virtue is no matter." Still, this letter greatly eased him, for in the study of alchemy there was much importance placed on virtue, though he was finding an omega's virtue was quite different from an alpha's. For all that of Mycroft's letters continued to arrive, with their unwanted advice and books, and though he snarled at the letters, he was somewhat relieved that he'd not been forgotten, now that he was further locked away from the world. Sherlock, who had never been alone, but always followed by his household, to see to his needs, was now always so in the tower. Sherlock ranged the tower's four rooms, as he had once ranged the castle, and before that the court with its vast estate. Sometimes he sat before the door that opened on the courtyard, and watched feet go by and made observations to the flickering darkness. He set up his alchemical materials in the second tower and set to the great work. Sometimes he leaned out his window and read his books, glancing up from time to time to see what he could of the world. Now in his ranging study, he chanced to read in The Alchemy of Heat by Hermes Trigamestris upon an alchemaic description of the bond. His lip quite curled to read the description of the lesson in an Omega's submission to the Magnus Magister, the Knot, where the soul's struggle against the unyielding will of the divine must be made to give way, for only then could transmutation of the soul then occur. He'd have flung the book quite out the window, but he did not have so many books that he could afford to do so. He turned his face to the sky and used the knowledge from his books to summon the wind that it might blow upon his face. He learned other magic, too, somewhat of use, others not, as he had no idea why he should wish to summon a fairy lover with which to breed. He wanted to fly, not be bred by a birdman. He longed to leave this tower, and in his mind, the library of the Convent of the Magdalene in Broceliande grew ever larger. In that library of the mind, he walked its aisles and selected from every book he'd ever heard of. He went there, and the dross of his body's transport fell away, and all that was left was his psyche. If in his mind the world grew larger, the place he was in could sometimes smaller grow. When desire scourged him with his heat, the Lady Beta, who ran the estate, would fasten a chain of cold iron to the wall, which to his ankle she would then affix, so that in his intemperate passions he'd not leap out the window, searching for some passing alpha, and so fall to ruin. The worst of it was that as he lay in sanguine heat, his humors were quite out of sort. He tugged upon that chain, such that later he'd find ringed scabs from his insistent attempts. After he was once more freed, he would always revel in being able to climb up and down the stairs, which he'd then do for hours. In the years that passed, Sherlock outgrew the bed set in the wall, as he grew quite tall, but as there was no space for another, he slept as a cat might do, all curled up. He leaned out the window and watched the world go by. His fate's cloak grew threadbare and thickly dusted in the ashes blown in from future winds. Now, as Sherlock was, always looking out, often others would look up and saw the prince's blooming beauty. For if his attractions had been well wrought at 13, they were nothing before what nature contrived, as he grew older yet. So it was that word of nature's art, quite set to overtake other rumors, for much do people like to speak on beauty. This was in part assisted by that Mycroft paid some 7 troubadours and some 7 troubarites to write poems upon this subject. He set them each out on the road with a purse of gold for their troubles, that they might sing the poems they wrote of the transcendent beauty locked away, much set upon the pious study of mystery. Now here I must digress. Let lords and ladies, on hearing of Mycroft's bounty, so clever he was later raised to the rulership of Rome in the West, remember to pay well the poets that they commission, to give them praise, lest it not be praise they give. But I'll not overdwell on it here, but save further for a later poem. Now the second son of the king of Gore heard these songs, and after some investigation, nothing would do but he get his father to send an offer for betrothal. As this prince was his father's favorite, this offer was soon sent, with a generous offer of dower settlement. His offer was not the only one, but his offer was the best, and with the best prospects for advancement. So Mycroft was inclined to favor it, and set those counselors that owed him favors to work upon his father, the king, while Mycroft tended to other matters in Rome. The counselors did their work well, and the king decided it was best to be rid of his half-born son. Now, as rumors of this betrothal set to fly, the Betas who kept the estate where Sherlock was kept gossiped on them hungrily. So Sherlock heard of them, sitting as he sometimes did, by the door that kept him in. His heart beat fast, for he knew that in a day or two his next heat would come, and when it passed, by then it might be too late to escape this fate of a hateful bonding. On this word, Sherlock's fate put on a thorny crown of iron, all tipped with blood, as the smoke of that bond blew on future winds to enfold him. However, Choice said no, and she placed the Convent of the Magdalene large in Sherlock's mind and laid before him his last opportunity. He reasoned that if he was now considered ripe enough to bond, he was now old enough to dedicate his life to the great mystery. He went upstairs and put on the collar and bracelets of gold enriched with gems that he'd been given as his inheritance at birth. He felt that he was certain to be accepted by the convent of the Magdalene in Broceliande if he had such as his dowry, despite his demon blood, although he planned to argue that it were their Christian duty to help him overcome it, and he was well armed with scriptures to prove it. Furthermore, he'd set his dowry as a surety that when his family came to collect him, the convent would hold them back, else they would lose what he gave them. With his chemicals, he made aqua regia in preparation for the night. As it fell, the castle grew quiet. He quite dissolved the lock of the door that kept him in. With a single hand, he pushed it open, and bringing now his most essential books and his lute, he set off on a palfrey from the stables. As he made his way from the estate, Choice shook off Fate's ashen cloak. Although that wind still blew upon him, she led him by the hand and pulled Sherlock's fate from the shadows and into the starry night. Sherlock rode all the night through, and as the sun rose, he came to the forest of Broceliande. The trees were grown quite close and dark, but he was excited enough to be almost singing. This was the first taste of freedom he'd had in long years, and he intended to savor it fully, like a simple broth brought before a starving man. Now, as it happened, he came to a fork in the road. He well knew that the path to the convent lay on the right, but on the left, he saw a signpost marked with the alchemical sign of a sleeping curse and warning. The curiosity that nature had so well crafted burned with a desire to see this curse, and know if after all his years of study, he could lift it. He reasoned, in addition, that the convent would still be there ere he was done, and he'd have years to enter into reflection in its library. So, unknowing of what fate his curiosity had chosen, Sherlock cantered down the leftward turning path. Choice, sitting next to fate atop the sign, gently kissed the fate that came of that decision upon the joining of neck and shoulder, and smiled at the shiver that came of that kiss. Fate arched his neck that these kisses might continue until his cloak of ash quite fell off, so warm he was. Choice pushed aside the blood-tipped crown with its barbs of iron, so that it fell to the ground, unmourned. Sherlock saw them not. He cantered swiftly down the path to his fate that came of this choice. The Romance of Mystery, Book 2, Chapter 2. Soon enough, he came to the ruins of a castle, over which there hung a yellow, bilious pall, which was all the evidence Sherlock needed to know what had occurred. He exclaimed loudly to the crows that whoever had lived here had clearly been fools of the highest order. The murder of crows had no answer, but cause. He summoned a breeze that he might enter the castle, and went fishing in the well. He soon confirmed that the water that it contained suffered from a sublimation of sulfur, which caused the yellow bilious gases, as the cure for this was well understood, or so he told the crows. He quickly balanced the teeming waters, and the noxious fumes abated. Not long to enjoy his triumph, as there was a great crashing noise at the castle gate. Into the courtyard came a mighty alpha ogre, some 10 feet tall. His red staff erect and sized as a young tree, and his wide, slathering mouth opened wide. On seeing Sherlock, the ogre let forth a lusty bellow. "Sweet, slick, slick, sweet, I'll cleave you first, and when I've split my fill, then eat you up. I'll eat you first and cleave the rest. Sweet, slick, slick, sweet." Sherlock needed to hear no further, but set off at a run for the gaping door of the castle's sole remaining tower, the ogre lumbering after. He raced through it just in time, as the ogre slammed against the stone that, though crumbling, held up against him. The gaping door was too narrow to allow the ogre entrance. Sherlock quickly raced up the stairs to be farther away from the ogre's reaching arm. As he climbed, he felt the first sign of heat as his Omega's prima materia dripped from his nether cheeks, and the horror of his situation unspooled fully before his mind. As long as the scent of heat came from him, the ogre would not leave this place. Even more troubling, when his heat was full upon him, and desire scourged him with his iron-tipped flail, his reason would fall away. He would do anything then to escape the burn of the whipping that desire gave him. He gave a sort of despairing laugh, for as he came to the tower's top room, upon the wall, he saw a chain such as the one in the tower that he'd left that very night, surely intended for the same purpose, to keep an Omega chaste. He affixed the chain with the simple bolt that it had around his ankle, and could only hope that as he had no lock, if he tugged against it, he'd come back to his better self, for he had no desire to either be despoiled or eaten, and certainly not both. So he stood in his new meaner tower, and wondered at the turn his life had taken. Then, from in the courtyard, he heard the sounds of a battle. After some time, the ogre's yells quite ceased, but with his heat blooming upon him, he dared do no more than remain in this place. He paced in the broken room to the length of the chain, but this in no way did help, but only served a reminder of the Omega Prima Materia that dripped between his thighs. Yet, even though it were not his first heat, and he were not a child, still he moved on a restless rhythm, all about that room, seeking to move ahead of desire's flail. Then he heard it, the sound of footsteps upon the stair. He thought to call out a warning, but could not think on what to say. And so he was silent. This story cannot speak of what he did not do, but of only what he did. Soon an alpha knight of pleasant aspect, with hair bleached to dusty blonde by the sun, and skin quite brown as a nut. To Sherlock's observations, all was quite clear in his history. The alpha's body was as thin as a lathe, but sturdy. The way he favored his shoulder and leg marked him as a wounded errant knight, just as clearly as the braided pilgrim's ribbons on his sleeve painted his history as a pilgrim. For in no way could he have grown so brown on Albion's misty shores. So Sherlock's first words to the alpha, as Sherlock sought to sharpen his heat-scourged wits, were, "Were you wounded in Edessa or Damascus?" The alpha stopped in his entry and stood all astonished, with wide blue eyes, and greatly it delighted Sherlock to see his astonishment, for it provided a distraction of moments from the ache in his flesh. "But how could you know that? By what magic is this known to you? Who has told you of me? But of greater import, how may I assist you? Who has chained you here, and why?" Sherlock was pleased, then, to lay the facts of the Alpha's life down before him. He waited for what always occurred these days, when he made his observations. He expected the Alpha's face to cloud with accusations of magic. And as Sherlock was an Omega man, he knew that in a moment the Alpha would decry that demon's blood must run sanguine all through Sherlock and leave the room. Instead, to Sherlock's wonderment, the Alpha exclaimed on Sherlock's brilliance. Would that he could have reveled in it, but desire lashed him doubly then, forcing from him a groan. With the discomfort of the prima materia flowing quite freely down his thighs, he arranged his cot and surcot and sat upon the sole seat in the room below the westerly window, the window itself but one of three gaping spaces onto the green world beyond. The Alpha came closer, but before Sherlock could say aught in panic, that he wanted naught of rutting, nor should the Alpha take from Sherlock what in his better state he did not want to give. The Alpha simply sat beside him. The steady sounds of the Alpha's breathing was like a lighthouse beam upon which Sherlock clung. So he laid his head down upon the Alpha's shoulder to ease the discomfort as his body clenched at airy nothing. Then, in his aching misery, the Alpha sweetly stroked his fingers through Sherlock's hair. It seemed to Sherlock then that it had been a very long time since he'd been so touched, if, in fact, ever at all. The brush of the Alpha's fingers upon Sherlock's cheek was a sweet comfort that set Sherlock's heart to leap in his chest. With all his book learning, he knew then that the Alpha was to Sherlock what Ovid in his Ars Amatoria had described as a collegium egregium, an excellent match for coupling. Sherlock knew in that moment that Ovid, far from too high a praise, as he described wooing his third bonded at the Colosseum, by having a slave sit on the other side, so his collegium egregium could not move away from his touch, had not done justice to the sweet sense of rightness that came when Alpha and Omega humors were in perfect accord, that he might taste the better of the oils of collegium egregium. For he knew all knowledge was good. He turned his face and lightly licked the Alpha's stroking palm. The Alpha pressed a kiss to his brow as if in answer. Then another dozen light kisses he gave, that each briefly burst with rightness upon Sherlock's brow. Even as his prima materia continued to drench his thighs, he forced his wits to keep thinking on the alchemy of the collegium egregium, which, as described in the book Gloria Mundi, was made of pure prima materia, which in its chaotic state had been composed of both Alpha and Omega. So it was they ever strove to mix together and be so joined again in heated rut. In the midst of his thoughts, the Alpha asked him on his story, and Sherlock told him briefly of his tale, while stretching his arm around the alpha, that he might match him touch for touch, for all knowledge is good, and he would know what it felt like to touch one who was so rightly aligned with himself. But soon, the comfort of this touch faded. Sherlock's flesh quailed beneath desire's increasing lashing, and he could not suppress a groan. The Alpha turned in his seat to press his lips to Sherlock's, and then, as if he too wished for a taste, he slipped his tongue into Sherlock's mouth. Sherlock returned this favor and enjoyed it well. As they sat there, engaged in tasting each other's mouths, Sherlock reflected that if he did not soon pull away, he was sure to lose his virtue in rutting, and by being thereby bred, put his goal of self-perfection ever farther away. Yet he reasoned there was no harm in tasting for a moment more. In that moment, and the many that followed, nature and nurture sat within that chamber, all unseen by the Alpha and Sherlock. Nature said, "I made Omegas that by the fire of their heat might prove a perfect forge to the Alpha's iron." She pressed a light kiss to Nurture's cheek, who by that kiss might be inclined to put on her Omega presentation, but instead moved to sit away from Nature, who wore an Alpha's scent that day. Nurture said, "Well, I say that it is not meet that breeding should occur outside of bond, that goodly inheritance and good family lines thus be managed, as well as it is a grievous sin. But without my aid, that inheritance would come to fallow fields. I but obey the command to be fruitful and multiply, which is God's first command, before all the rest." She moved closer then, and placed her hand upon Nurture's plump breast, and lightly brushed her there. Nurture squirmed in her seat, but did not pull away. She rather, with desperation in her voice, said, "But it is not meet that a unbonded Omega be bred by an Alpha, and certainly not a Omega that I carefully trained for reason's sway, and armed then with all the knowledge that he could bear. But 'twas I who gave him a thirst for more." Nature unlaced Nurture's cot, the better to advance her argument. "Long years after birth, you grant your gifts, but ne'er forget, it is I who grant them first. It is I who gave this Omega all his wits, as it was I who granted this Alpha his faithful heart, that each to the other might be an excellent match, and delight me by breeding together." Nurture lost the thread of her argument for a time, as Nature bent her head to give playful suck to both her breasts, but weakly said, By logic's course, the Omega should from this Alpha turn away, that to the great work he might stay true." Nature lifted Nurture's skirts, that an Alpha's delving she might further do, murmuring as she went, "A cold comfort that would be." And so the philosopher's stone all his life would elude him. Better equipped to delve into mystery would he be with an Alpha I made for him. So saying, Nature delved Nurture to nurture quite agreed. So upon that agreement, nurture whispered on one side and nature whispered on the other. So Sherlock reasoned that he and the alpha might do much to ease his ache that need not go so far as rot. Indeed, they gave him a plan upon which he strongly latched, as a drowning man latches upon a reed. They reminded him that he'd already been granted papal dispensation for strokes of a beta staff, even buried up to its root. Not knowing nature's intention, he further reasoned that a stroke from the alpha would grant him ease, just as the beta stroke had done before. As it would be but a single stroke, it could do no harm, and further, if a single stroke, there could be no difference between a beta and an alpha. Further still, with none to interrupt them, the act of which need never be known, except to his confessor. Having convinced himself, he considered how best to sway the alpha to this plan. As the alpha wore pilgrim's ribbons, he was clearly devout, which pleased Sherlock, for surely he would then have all the greater self-control. So when next Sherlock cried out, he cried out for God's mercy. The alpha's next kiss delved even deeper, and Sherlock knew he'd found the right way. He opened his eyes and pulled away as if modesty had overcome him. Sir Knight, you have done me a great service by killing the ogre. Can you not see your way to the sweeter one of easing my discomfort in such a way as would please you well, but would leave me as yet unbred? Sherlock placed his fingers upon the alpha's lips to stop his protestation, and chose his words with great care. Such is the prestige of my family, that I have been given papal dispensation for a stroke or 20 from a beta staff in my time of heat. Just one such stroke from your staff would ease me well. Knowing the value in it, he threw back his head and cried out, as a supplicant cries out for mercy from God. Not that all his cries were for show, but certainly he made them with a craft that would put a player to shame. Beside him, nature applauded. Nurture shook her head in shame. The alpha's breath quickened, and Sherlock opened his eyes a slit to see the alpha bite at his lip in the blaze of the idea. But still, he had not yet said yes. He must press on, else lose all advantage. He placed his hand upon the alpha's chest, and hid a smile at the alpha's catch of breath. Please, Sir Knight, see how I am suffering. Please, I assure you, it is nothing that I have not done before. Sherlock reasoned that this was no untruth, mere hyperbole, and he'd say what he had to if it gained him the stroke he needed. He groaned again, and this was no ruse, for desire abused him hard. Slowly, the alpha said in a way that implied there was only one remaining brick in the wall of his resolve against Sherlock's plan. But, as you yourself have said, the tongue that had but lately explored Sherlock's mouth came forth to wet his lips. Your dispensation is for a beta, which I am not. Sherlock was prepared for this objection, having but lately convinced himself that one was the same as the other. Sherlock pressed his face into the Alpha's neck, that he might fully take advantage of the Collegium Egregium's effect upon the Alpha. Which is why I ask for only one stroke. One stroke. He made a small lick of his tongue to enjoy the taste of the Alpha's flesh, so closely warmed by his blood, having been granted dispensation for 1 or 20 of a beta, then surely one from an Alpha would be much the same as a beta's 100. There was no reason to relate that the act had come first, and then the dispensation. Sherlock took another taste of the Alpha's neck, and felt him shudder then. You possess the key, meant for the lock that I hold. How much better the fit, and the more likely that it will grant ease on one stroke. Please, Sir Knight, will you not grant me the ease for which we already have dispensation that makes it no sin? The Alpha exhaled as a bellows might. His voice was hoarse. I am no scholar to argue with your logic. I will do it. Sherlock let out his own breath and paused not. Now that he had the Alpha's agreement, lest in hesitation he lose it, he sought out some location that would grant him the most benefit from the stroke. He turned round in the window seat and lifted up his cot and surcot, before leaning forward that he might best present his nether cheeks. Glancing back to gauge the Alpha's height, he saw the Alpha pull forth his staff, which was well ready for the task, and seemed thrice again what Victor's had been. Far from giving him pause, this, Sherlock felt, quite confirmed him in his logic. The red blunt head of the Alpha's staff, like a spear, already beaded with the Alpha's prima materia. Here, his thought was only on alchemy when he reached out his hand and touched the weeping point so he could taste it then from his finger. The Alpha's prima materia was bitter as French sage, but not displeasing. Then, not wishing to tarry more, he turned away, even as the Alpha groaned a prayer to Christ above. The Alpha placed his hands upon Sherlock's thighs in a most caressing grip. Rather than begin a slow push in, he lightly rested the blunt head of his staff against the entrance of Sherlock's opening, that wept with his own prima materia, and seemed content to lightly circle, rather than fill that which Sherlock most desired to be filled. Sherlock wanted not this touch, if it denied him the stroke, for which he had full dispensation and the right to receive. As you love Jesus, Sir Knight, do not tease me so. I am in great discomfort. A single stroke is all I beg of you. Please give me what you have agreed to. What then occurred bore as much resemblance to Sherlock's past experience as a reed bears resemblance to a sapling. It resembled what had gone before, as a pond bears resemblance to a lake. When Victor had fumbling pushed in his staff, easing Sherlock's ache and nothing more, the Alpha speared in one great thrust, as a pikeman might do. Far from merely filling, The alpha's girth stretched Sherlock's channel, even as his length quite filled him up. Sherlock could feel the head of the alpha's staff press a sip of prima materia against the thirsty mouth of Sherlock's womb. This did not even then touch upon the alpha's knot, which, while far from the theological magnus magister of Sherlock's reading, quite pleasingly rubbed as it made its way in. All this Sherlock exclaimed upon, so greatly pleased was he by the success of his idea. He cursed then the impulse that had him move his hips, that he might get further surcease that motion brings, as this seemed a sign for the alpha to withdraw. Sherlock felt the loss as the breaking of a rope that a prisoner in his tower had intended for freedom, and instead leaves him on the ground gasping for breath until he is taken into his tower once more. Sherlock quickly reasoned, so pleasing had that stroke been. Surely it would only take but a stroke more to leave him fully eased. He bargained with himself that as he'd been granted further strokes, he should have them, else they go wanting. Sir Knight, I am in great suffering. Will you not grant me the ease of a second stroke, for which dispensation is already granted us? As once you've given, surely it were no sin to grant again. Please, I beg of you, another stroke is all I ask. In answer to his plea, the alpha generously thrust in once more, with the assurance of a knight of the joust. Once more, the blessed fulfillment, as the alpha's head kissed a sip of alpha prima materia against Sherlock's womb, well watered with his own omega prima materia. As the philosophers opined, both were full of longing to once more be mixed. Once more, on being filled, Sherlock could not resist that slight stretch which signaled his fresh yearning as the alpha slowly withdrew. Sherlock, clinging to the reed of his dispensation, for 3 was less than 20, and he'd been granted 20 or more. Oh, sweet Jesus, grant me mercy. It is only through your knotted staff that I find surcease. We have dispensation. Please, as you love God, fill me again. Once more, in answer to his plea, the alpha unstintingly thrust in, as sure and steady as a king may throw alms to the reaching crowd. Certainly none, not even Ovid, had written of the white pleasure spikes that pierced through him, as the alpha's staff furrowed past a previously unknown spot within Sherlock's channel. Sherlock kept up a steady stream of words through all of this. He spoke on the staff that stretched him, and the kissing blunt head, and the sips of prima materia, and the alpha's pleasing knot. Sherlock could not fathom why it was written as harshly gripping, as it slid inside of him to rub against that wondrous spot. Still, Sherlock could not resist that stretch. Now that he knew that spot was there, he wanted it 100 times so furrowed. Surely that was not too much. He quickly calculated, and he was due some 500 less 20 strokes for all the years of want, and these now he'd demand his due, as was his right. Do not stint with your mercy. Again, we have dispensation for 500 more. Again, Please, again. Now, no longer pausing, but like a blacksmith at the bellows breathing hard, like a conqueror racing to the city that has thrown open wide its gates in welcome, like an alpha deep in rut within his heated omega, his alpha set on an unsparing course within Sherlock, who wanted all that was due him, who wanted all to which he had the right. So in a stream, Sherlock urged his alpha on, again, sweet Jesus, again, as his alpha unstintingly gave Sherlock what he'd asked for. Indeed, as if in answer to his cries, his alpha's knot swelled as it made an increasingly demanding passage through Sherlock's entrance and pushed ever deeper furrows across that wondrous spot. Sherlock here mocked the innocent he'd been but moments before. He'd been so pleased with the first stroke and the first passage of his alpha's knot. Now the truth was revealed, as his alpha's furious strokes only increased his knot's girth and made it Magnus Magister indeed, which imperiously commanded Sherlock's pleasured cries as a rightful due, the granting of which only swelled it more to Sherlock's escalation of delight. Using the window as a brace, Sherlock strongly moved in a counter-motion that increased the power of each returning stroke, such that as his alpha was couched, his staff's head pressed a kiss inside the mouth of Sherlock's thirsty womb, even as his knot, with increasing command, like Caesar, arriving in Rome for a triumph of old, firmly pressed upon that wondrous spot to the showering of Sherlock's shouted cries, while the outward moving loss induced another plea that his alpha return again, which his alpha unsparingly granted. For a time, pleasure held sway. Then his alpha, who until that moment had been unstintingly generous, now held back and teased Sherlock with shallow strokes while merely pressing his imperious knot against Sherlock's entrance without deigning to enter the gate that most longed for its arrival. Sherlock cried out, "Why do you hold back? The Pope himself has given me clemency for strokes up to the root. For charity's sake, do not begrudge me the relief that is due me. Please, for God's sake, grant me another stroke." And thus he urged his alpha to his former imperious largesse. To his dismay, he heard his alpha answer, "If I do not withdraw, I will not within." Of which statement, only the word withdraw stood out in sharp relief. Faced with the loss of all, and certain he was owed at least several hundred strokes more, Sherlock said, "As you love God, sweet mercy, dispensation, again." Even as he spoke these words, his alpha granted him his request with a mighty thrust. But fearing it would not be enough, Sherlock pushed back with all his might that his alpha's knot would once again pass within on its imperious course. Whether he was then rewarded for his efforts cannot be said, only that the word again still trembled on Sherlock's lips, already thinking ahead to the next stroke, when all stroking was ended. his alpha's not, quite rapidly transmuted from demanding to true Magnus Magister, a great philosopher's stone that quite bound Sherlock at the door of his entrance and fell there to cleaving Sherlock in twain. Further injury, then, the staff that he had so cried out for now a plowshare became, for the head that had so delighted him with its kisses of prima materia against his wound's thirsty mouth, now firmly lodged within that mouth's throat, fountained forth such a river of the stuff as his womb had no choice but to choke down this flood of primal matter that would surely breed him. Sherlock struggled then, in great panicked cries, to escape the fate that he himself had cozened. He bent forward in the window, but was tightly hoist on the petard of his own actions, and could not break free of the knotty staff that, but a moment before, he had cried out to God in heaven for the sweet mercy of another stroke. It seemed now a horror that from his home he had fled straight into this fate with a stranger. The greater he struggled, the more pain he felt. He cried out, "Sweet Jesus, it is too much. You are cleaving me in half. I did not ask for this. I asked for a single stroke. It is too much. I cannot bear it. I did not ask to be bred. Let me go at once." Pax, sweet Pax, unthinking, a grievous sin have I committed with my last thrust, but on my soul now it's done. I cannot free you of this fate. The alpha rested his head upon Sherlock's back, full of the alpha's prima materia and his own resentment. Sherlock cared not for the alpha's unwanted words. As the present flood stopped its fountain, the alpha reached beneath Sherlock's cot and surcot and took hold of Sherlock's staff, which till now had been all but forgotten. He stroked quite winningly until Sherlock found a sort of stunned release that flew from him and fell from the window to where he knew not. Spitefully bottled up as he was, he wished that the alpha staff would send its prima materia the same place, but his wish was not to be. Instead, from the blunted head that had once granted such delight, now fountained forth a second hateful river, much to Sherlock's enraged disbelief. With hope of escape quite blocked, he yielded to the knot's binding and slumped back against the alpha who so gripped him, as he submitted to that which could not be resisted, but rather stretched to accept it, the knot no longer painfully pulled taut against his entrance, but rather now fully pressed with all its force upon the wondrous spot. And what had been pleasing was now equal to the knot that gripped it. Further, his alpha's prima materia had now fully mixed with his own omega prima materia, and so returned to its primal state of both alpha and omega. Such a mixture is by its nature volatile, and could not long endure, so it released to an explosion within Sherlock, as to mimic the one with which the cosmos began, and by that power would life within Sherlock engender. With release, rolling over him in waves, his cries then were to his previous, as the lake is to the ocean, and the sapling is to the oak. Through all of this, his alpha kept up a steady stroke upon Sherlock's staff, stopping only for some new fount of prima materia that now Sherlock's womb with satisfaction gulped, until quite indulgently engorged it became. revelation, whose name is Sophia, tried then to speak, but neither of them could hear her over the sound of their pleasure-drunk cries. As these faded, his Alpha pressed his face to Sherlock's back. Sweet Jesus, and now I know why this position of love is called ruin, for well have I ruined you to our soul's peril. Sherlock laughed now, for so had satisfaction washed his fears, that he felt new baptized in delight. Finally, this was the ruin against which he had been constrained. He felt as if he were filled with a golden light that might now lift him up to float away. All he could do was let forth the laughter that now filled him at this content. So this is ruin. He shifted his hips, such that he could tug upon the knot, and yet so further brush against that wondrous spot. The Alpha let forth another flood, which Sherlock welcomed now, for the fulfillment it gave, which left no room for regret. Sherlock laughed like the bell that rang on the cathedral when his brothers each presented. It had been silent when he'd so done. He rang it with his voice now, and marveled at the world. Sherlock bent his head down and yielded to further release. They knelt thus upon the window, until such time as his Alpha's philosopher's stone gave way, and his Alpha slipped from him. The impediment removed, the material of Sherlock's heat, mixed with his Alpha's prima materia, trickled down his legs, spent to the generative power that Sherlock knew surely must have begun the process that would breed him. Still, full of content, and for the moment no longer lashed by desire, Sherlock spread his arms wide and reveled in the ruin of all virtue and expectation. Without committing the sin, I journeyed to the convent of the Magdalen, where I would have served the penance. It can only be God's will that I now tumble into that for which I would have paid. Would that he'd known the joy that waited upon this turn of events. But no, he laughed again. He'd have not believed it. No wonder they had kept him so locked up, if this was where a sanguine nature led. In his present state, he could only laugh. The Romance of Mystery, Book 2, Chapter 3. As the chain held no purpose, Sherlock removed it. A laugh still lodged in his chest, and his limbs felt as if he'd dipped the bones in vinegar, and they had become quite soft. Sherlock's head felt as if it were still ringing with what he had just experienced with the stranger. It was his Alpha who seemed most stunned by what had happened. He could see a sort of sorrow creep moment by moment across his Alpha's face. He knew that he should, but he could feel no sorrow. He first stroked his Alpha, and then wrapped his body around his Alpha. He towered over him, who was quite 2 hands' breadth shorter than Sherlock. He nearly laughed then. For though his Alpha were small, Sherlock's flesh yet rang in a way that said his Alpha was quite large enough, where he pleased Sherlock the most. It was this thought that finally gave him pause, as it was a sign that though desire no longer flailed him, his heat still overturned his reason. Quite simply, this Alpha was a stranger, though now bound to him by what they had done. He was in no way his. Yet Sherlock had never known aught but wanton heat, To be drunk on plenty was a new sensation. So full as he was, he could only think that meant the work of heat was well begun. Here he made a theory in advance of the facts. He theorized that when his heat flailed him again, surely the force of it must be muted enough for Sherlock to journey on. And if this were so, well, he knew that the work of heat might yet be thwarted. For he'd had cause to study much the work of the alchemist Jabir, whose quest for Taquin, the creation of life, had led to the study of why heat continued after the first not well-mixed prima materia. Jabir had opined, with few opportunities for practical application, as he was a beta, that heat was a 12-step process, and it was the reapplication of prima materia at each stage that led to the engendering of life. So when his alpha spoke of leaving, Sherlock echoed that desire. As if his thoughts were in a smoky haze, it seemed to him that he should not want to complete the process they'd well begun. That his alpha wished to leave him felt a sort of discordant note on the echo of release. But he reminded himself that they were strangers to each other, and if leaving him could subvert the work of heat, he should do it. This alpha was not his, and for all he could read his history, they should remain strangers. Choice, dizzy-minded with heat, attempted then to turn towards a different fate, all clothed in ash upon a throne of splintered bone, as Sherlock pulled away from the alpha. Sherlock told himself that within the convent's walls, he would engage his whole purpose to the study of a higher mystery. He told the alpha as much, although he was wont to further laughter, to hear the alpha speak as if Sherlock did not full well know the limits the world put on him. So it was when the alpha gave his name as Sir John, and asked Sherlock's in return. He opened his mouth to speak his hated Dalpha name, and instead answered, "You may call me Mystery." As he walked down the stairs, Sherlock felt the mixed prima materia drain from him, and with it his contempt, which seemed all part of his draining mood. In the courtyard, he paused to gaze upon the corpse of the ogre, who'd thought to rut and kill him, and instead was killed by Sir John, who'd then rutted with Sherlock, and would now leave. From his previous height of mood, now his heart felt heavy, as if he had rocks piled upon his chest. Yet, on turning, he found Sir John standing there beside him. He reached for Sir John, and on the content of embracing him, those rocks as butterflies became, quite flown away. He tasted Sir John's mouth there beside the corpse of the monster Sir John had slain. He reveled in what his alpha had done to win him, for in that moment it seemed as if surely that was what had happened. Knowing the cost of further coupling, and yet it seemed a most marvelous result, for in that time of sliding tongues, and how marvelous John tasted to him, and caressing hands filling him with want, it seemed only the most logical thing that having begun the practical experiment upon Jabir's theory, he should have the pleasure of continuing on that path. The first experiment of any theory needs must provide a baseline for all the rest. So he reasoned it was not for his own benefit that he engage at all 12 stages of heat with Jean, but for alchemy. And as to the supposed sin of it, Sherlock reasoned with himself that St. Augustine considered heat to be set upon omegas by God. And who were he to argue? And indeed, if it were a sin, like Augustine, he'd repent it later. And a well-plowed field need not fear what comes of further furrows. he'd reason what he must to get the key for the lock he would hold. Reasons fell away soon enough. He tore aside Sir John's clothes, the better to touch him. He marveled at the places where Sir John was not brown, and where they were commonly pale. Sir John unlaced Sherlock from his own, and it felt as if Sherlock breathed for the first time in years. No sumptuary laws now, but skin rubbed against skin, with all his body a flashpoint of the burning where Alpha and Omega met. Above him was only Sir John and sky, the color of Sir John's eyes. Below him the sweet, tall grass, warmed by the sunshine. Beside them the crows, feasting on what his Alpha had killed to have him. On the sounds of avian banqueting, Sherlock lifted his legs, and Sir John thrust in once more. This time as they coupled, Sherlock could see Sir John's face all the while, and so he knew his own was revealed. Both were exposed in all ways, and though strangers to each other, they moved to a common purpose under the hot sun to set his Alpha's philosopher's stone, where in that moment they both most wanted it to be. Prima materia to prima materia, mixing once more to a volatile explosion that set Sherlock's ears to ringing and angels to leaping from their perches on the celestial spheres, while the crows were likewise driven. So caws mixed with the sound of heavenly singing. How well Sherlock loved his ruin then. As they lay locked together, choice dizzy on the incense of heat, rolled the dice for what was to be. On the results of that roll, she embraced the fate that might come of it and rejoiced. For choice likes to play games of chance with fate. Most especially she and fate engage at play, where couples are driven by dubious desire to grapple in acts that make three. So Sherlock and John's first coupling had well mixed prima materia, it was true. It was also true that choice rolled the dice and knew that what had been engendered by it might not yet come to pass. As the forfeit was fate's, he bared his neck for choice's kiss, and shivered as a mark there bloomed in the shape of what might be. The second time, too, the dice were rolled, and pleasure-drunk choice said, "My luck is good." Fate smiled, "Then mine as well." And as desire was the rule, he slipped off his shift, the better to welcome choice in, while all the while the lovers kept on. Now, as Eve's sin was Sherlock's own, he was determined to pluck all the fruit and know all. He'd learn everything his Alpha knew, and in his heat, this seemed the most reasonable course. They did not know how fate smiled in anticipation when back within the tower, Sir John spread out a blanket that Sherlock might lie on it, and Sir John tangle with Sherlock. Even while they were still contented from their previous coupling, Sir John pressed his lips to Sherlock's. Sir John whispered, "This is the Castilian kiss." Then pressing a tongue inside Sherlock's mouth, they enjoyed each other's mouths a time. "This is the French." It was later, far later, that Sir John delved a Catalan kiss, to Sherlock's astonished delight. Sherlock enjoyed these kisses, but by the rising sanguine humor of his body, "I am greedy for more than kisses, although they are sweet." Sir John slid a finger then inside Sherlock and taught him the wondrous spot's name. "This then is called the Pearl of Pleasure. Perhaps your beta friend told you of it?" "No, I see he kept you in ignorance." Sherlock learned that when an Alpha's staff first breached an Omega's entrance, had a name. "This is called Dawning of Delight, and by some meaner folks, the Furrowing of the Plough." He burnished then Sherlock's pearl with the head of his staff. Sir John said in answer to Sherlock's delight, "This is called obeisance to tears, for pearls are for tears, and see how your body weeps as I do this." Sherlock breathed hard and said, "You are no mean teacher, but please, Sir John, press on with your lesson." Sir John did not tarry then, in granting surcease for them both, as Sir John's staff made a kiss of prima materia against Sherlock's thirsty womb. "And this is called the arrival at the gates of heaven." Sherlock wrapped his legs around Sir John. "I much like this position. What is it called?" On learning it was named Spread Eagle, he playfully moved his legs as if to fly. "I would that you would demonstrate each of these again, but with greater speed." Sir John smiled broadly. "I will do it," even unto observing his fealty to Sherlock's scepter. For so John taught him in this context it was to be called. Until the prima materia within Sherlock's staff caused their skin to cling together, whilst within Sir John released some new flood, that the next stage of alchemy within Sherlock might be completed. As he to Sir John was once more gripped tight in the haze of heat, Sherlock could not decide if they were at congelation or conjugation in the process that created life. He laughed to think that the alchemist Jabir had spent his entire life in the quest of the creation of life. This were no laboratory, but still alchemy seemed simple in that moment. When John, released of the cries that came with his latest flood, said, "You keep laughing as we finish." Sherlock stretched. "It is funny." He tried to explain why, but became distracted by sensation, all the while not knowing that Choice rolled the dice once more, and once more won her turn, to the satisfaction of Sherlock's fate. They did not stop there. Sherlock had Sir John lay down upon his back, and knelt over him, and asked, "What then is this called?" "Riding astride," was all Sir John could say, before Sherlock wriggled down upon Sir John's staff like an eel, and took to teasing the both of them, before he set to a bouncing canter that pleased them well. Penitent before God pleased Sherlock also. Likewise did the flying buttress, which set the stones to ringing with their cries. Less so sitting upon the throne, which was awkward, so Sherlock requested they shift back to ruin. Lest you think they spent the entire time in coupling, they spoke too, wrapped around each other between soft Castilian kisses. Sir John told Sherlock of the glittering court of Byzantium. He spoke of the dust and smoky scent of Jerusalem. He did not say he missed wandering the wide world. He did not need to say it. He spoke of courtly love, where an alpha might serve a bonded omega, to the increased courtesy of the alpha. He spoke of his fealty to the Lady Vert, and how she'd driven him from Camelot. Sherlock, in his turn, spoke French a while, inside Sir John's mouth, before speaking of the tower. He was silent on the subject of Victor. He spoke of the window that had opened on the world. But he did not speak of the small bed on the wall, in which he'd slept all curled up. He spoke of his dreams of study, but he did not speak of his fears of being locked away. He drank in the way Sir John's pleasant face quite lit up when Sherlock was clever and told him so. He feared the misstep that, as demon's child he was, he would surely make that would cloud Sir John's face against him. Still, his whole body rang with the echoes of what they did, and it seemed the only logical course was to lay on. In truth, they spent most of their time coupling, so remained to each other well-known strangers. Time and again, Choice rolled the dice and crowed to be a victor, and took her forfeit. So it was as the heat that nature set was fading. Sherlock whispered in a voice rough with shouting, "Again, Sir John, again!" So John's knot caught in Sherlock for a final time. Choice made her final roll and came up wanting. Good game! And fate, now fastened with the child of choice, said, "I certainly found it so." And between them they laid out nature's tools for her arrival. Nature, having just returned from other tasks, found the prima materia's mixture finally ready, like risen dough, picked up her tools, and set to quickening the primal materials in the needed way, and then to making a child with careful art and science. The Romance of Mystery, Book 2, Chapter 4. So came the morning, covering every surface with dew. Sherlock woke and found his heat had ended, and with it returned his mind. It was as if a pall of dizzying smoke had overlaid all his previous actions. And now the sun rose brightly over the wreckage. He told himself that he could recover from this fall. Alchemy was, after all, about burning away dross, no matter how gross the material. But what had been difficult might now be impossible. He echoed with loss, and knew not where to find the answer to this feeling. Prince as he was, and by dispensation of untrammeled virtue, he'd made this journey knowing that upon taking up the veil, he'd have found his way to higher estate within the church. With an uncle in the papal court, and Mycroft's aid, if his brother could be brought to see the right of it, his position would have been quite good. Having proved himself, Sherlock could have grown to the height of any order, not for power, but for the access to knowledge that would bring. There would have been no library that would be closed to him. There would have been no pilgrimage that in time he could not assay. Now he faced quite a different fate. Those doors before him were surely locked. Alone, the convent of the Magdalene itself still lay open to him. He swallowed down a hollow laugh, quite unlike the ones he'd been given to over the last few days. For now, he'd need no more dour settlement than the one he and John had labored to place within his belly. Wittingly, he'd used his rhetoric to be bred, and there was no way from it. At best, he could hope for a quiet life within convent walls that once closed would ne'er open again. He comforted himself that at least their library was good. Revelation, whose name is Sophia, standing there, might have spoken, but she saw Sherlock's ears were as if plugged with wax, and so she was silent. He looked at Sir John, chaste action, firmly now beside Sherlock, and much aghast at what had occurred in her absence, held him firmly. Sherlock did not reach out to hold Sir John's lips for the comfort that might bring. He had no right to it. He had delighted for days in being bred by a stranger. He could not decide which aspect of that was the worst. Sir John, now once more in his rough-boiled armor shell, said most softly, "I can smell the change in your scent. My seed has caught root." Sherlock put on his cot and surcot, and tried to put back on chastity, as if chastity could be so simply done. The circlet of his wimple felt tight on his head, and could not hide the truth of things. He wanted to explain that breeding involved no seeds, but a complex mixture of primal materials that then underwent a 12-stage process in the creation of life, but it would have required a background in alchemy. Yet, it felt as if all they had done over these days, now upon his heart there grew a tender plant that yearned towards Sir John, as if a true plant which yearns towards the light. So perhaps there had been a seed of sorts. Sherlock smiled to think that Sir John spoke truly, without even knowing it. So he meant something quite different than John perhaps supposed, as he replied, "That is only sense, given a watering of it." Looking at Sir John, his thought was, "I need to know this stranger with whom I have bred, that I might understand what has occurred," though he knew this to be the sin of Eve within him. And yet it was the standard by which he lived his life, to love knowledge. Knowing could not happen through parting. If he spent a day or so unclouded by heat smoke, his vision was such that he'd learn what he needed to know. He invited Sir John upon his journey. For the day or so, that would purchase them. Sir John said, "Oh God, yes!" The echo of so many cries over the days before. Sherlock had to close his eyes for a moment, once again, as chaste action held him back from embracing Sir John. They passed the crow-pecked corpse of the ogre, and Sherlock paused to spit upon it. "Goodbye, ogre. As you may have heard from our cries, Sir John and I coupled many times since last I saw you." This was a more bitter remark than his earlier taunts. Sir John helped him mount his palfrey, and at his touch, Sherlock felt that rightness once more. He told himself that this was not but the effects of a collegium egregium well fed on constant touch and heat, which now must fade, now that heat had gone to cold ashes. They went on their way. Sherlock realized his error then, for every step of the horse reminded Sherlock of all they'd done, and not in a pleasant manner, for they had used his flesh well these last few days. When Sir John asked if he might apply the salve to where Sherlock most hurt, Sherlock took the words he wanted to hear. He wanted the rightness of comfort that Sir John's touch would bring. Let it be understood, he meant nothing unchaste by his actions. Now, chaste action here might have spoken, but revelation, who is called by some Sophia, laid two fingers against chaste action's lips. Seeing who stayed her, chaste action bowed in obeisance and turned away as Sophia directed. Sherlock slid from his palfrey and presented his nether cheeks to Sir John for healing. Sir John was a natural healer. He got down on his knees in the dirt and carefully applied the salve to Sherlock's thighs. It were soothing to be touched. Sir John applied the salve to Sherlock's much-used entrance, and Sherlock was forced to hold back a gasp. He slipped a finger in, and with it lightly pressed upon Sherlock's much-furrowed pearl, and spread healing there, too. At these touches, though not in heat, and in full possession of his mind, yet Sherlock felt himself gently lashed by desire. In that moment, Sherlock would that Sir John had anointed his staff, and stroke healing so. It was an astonishing thought, and he freshly understood his own sanguine nature. Here, at least, by Sir John's own description, The world had created a method to yoke such sanguine thoughts through courtly love. As Sir John was the expert in this, he put it to him that Sir John should be his vassal in courtly love, and by the language of such, he would become Sherlock's friend, which seemed a goodly thing. John accepted Sherlock's offer, and took Sherlock's scepter twixt his lips, and worshipped there, until Sherlock, even biting lips, could not hold back release. It was only after, with chaste action and non-stop speech at his ears, and looking at the open road upon which he stood, that he reflected on how poorly his actions spoke of him, and the ash of his own expectations filled him anew. Yet, that night, Sherlock declined Jean's offer for separate pallets, and a sort of all things between them. He wanted nothing between them, and yet soon a convent wall would separate them. He knew that even now they should grow apart, based on where their paths led. Sherlock tossed and turned, and with a hollow heart gave way to what he wanted. He pressed his head to Jean's chest, and listening to the steady beat of his heart, was much comforted. He felt the ease of rightness from the collegium egregium of Sir John's skin. The stunted, jealous, greedy plant growing on his heart was nothing like love, as St. Paul had described it. It had him curl up with his arm across Jean, and one leg bent over him. Still, primal love, although unseen, stood by and smiled. Jean reached up his hand, and even as he had on that first day, he stroked his fingers through Sherlock's hair, and it was sweet. Sherlock said, "Tell me of Jerusalem." As a prince of an order, he might once have been able to make that journey, but not now. Now he made the journey on John's voice, as he spoke of dusty roads, markets full of spices, and small sights of ancient wonder. Though Sherlock had long been one who had trouble sleeping, he had no difficulty then, drowsing deeply, wrapped around Jean, with Jean's hand in his hair. He dreamed that they traveled to Jerusalem together. In the morning, they set out on the road in the forest. They came to the fork in the road that on the right led to the convent of the Magdalene. The thought of the convent walls closing round him seemed more of a tomb than a haven. The valley in which it lay, more of fear than of safety. He wished he had something to give that Jean might remember him by. He walked through the infinite library in his mind, and found an entry on a hot spring that lay upon the leftward turning path, and of the night that so guarded it, it seemed to him that he could do his friend a good turn by better equipping him before they parted. The leftward turning path they took. Sherlock fell into melancholy, and as they left the crossing behind, he wrestled with himself. He wrestled with the self that had stood at the crossroads and chosen to ride away from the great work. But he had already ridden by that self. Even as he left behind the foolish Omega, who'd asked an Alpha for a single stroke and exclaimed in joy at a burgeoning knot. Even as he left behind the man locked in the tower, looking out the window, and he wondered what his life would have been had he remained and simply refused the bond his family set before him. Even as he left behind the boy run wild at court, and he wondered what would have come if he had not been set aside, he wrestled that he might turn back and turn towards the study of self-perfection. where he should be burning impurity away. He was now pouring more in. Furthermore, by the accord of every tongue since his presentation, he had always been so impure that there'd be nothing left if he burned the dross away. And now he proved it. He rode ever on. On their way, they passed a Beta Carter, going the other direction. The Beta pulled his lock at them, and by his eyes on Sherlock's unblemished neck and the flare of his nose, Sherlock knew that the villain took them for what they were, a heated Omega, fessened out of bond, and the errant Alpha who'd rutted that Omega in a hedge or field to make him so. An Omega, without even the excuse of heat, had begged for that Alpha's service upon an open road. So this was ruin. Sherlock did not love his ruin then. He did not share this observation with Jean. He held it quite bottled up. So like a bubbling pot, with its lid, he quite snapped at Jean. Dear friend Jean, who stopped and almost left him upon the road. Jean, who was free to leave the wood and travel the world, even to the kingdom of Jerusalem. Jean, who journeyed willingly with Sherlock upon this small adventure. Sherlock made his apologies. He was so focused upon pacing in the aisles of the library of the Magdalen that dwelled in his mind that he did not notice the dark night attack until the sound of Jean's sword came to his ears. If he were right with the world, and the plant that strangled in the weeds of his heart were true, he'd be afeard for his friend. Instead, a demon child he must be, as he watched the battle in delight, while he himself stood back, the better to let Jean complete the first test, in which Sherlock had full confidence that Jean would well acquit himself. The dark night, which was again Comlacht, signaled by his motions that he had been appeased by Jean's skill in battle, and would now accept an offering. Sherlock cast the golden anklet from his right ankle to the ground. Naturally, when he had done so, the Dark Knight's armor collapsed upon it. This armor, as it was of magic origin, would now far better protect Jean than any armor blacksmiths make, and certainly exceeded his present boiled leather. Sherlock basked in Jean's amazement, and the cloud of his mood blew clear on Jean's smile. It was most marvelous that you knew what to do, but it seems that you have lost your anklet. Sherlock had intended it so from the moment they turned at the crossroads. He chanced to glance up, and all around them in the trees, as if stringing up a bower, there were deep red roses that clung to ancient branches and enriched the air with a soft perfume. He mused upon these flowers, which served no purpose. They filled no requirement for life. They provided no shelter, nor would they be consumed. They simply delighted the eyes and filled the air with sweetness to embellish life rather than prolong it. He gazed then upon his friend, whose visage glowed with victory as he touched his new armor. In that moment, Revelation, whose name is Sophia, laid her hands upon him and plucked from his heart choking weeds, as a gardener might do to let the tender plant that coupling had seeded there better grow. Released of that choking weight, he understood the meaning of what he'd just seen. The roses in that moment were an assurance of providence. They granted extras into life for the sake of goodness. If so drove his reasons, it were no sin to give extras, however long the road with his dear friend went, although the difficulty of choosing for goodness rather than base desire, seemed a daunting one. But only difficult things were worth doing. He thought upon it, and the answer came to him most swiftly, even as Sophia gently took chaste action by the hand and took her from that place, for she'd have no sway in guiding Sherlock from this point forward. Sophia glanced back once, but she saw that Sherlock was ready to hear no more. Primal love, seeing Sherlock was not yet ready to hear him, nevertheless remained. Sherlock went down to a pool that formed a sort of soaking tub, saying, "Come, my friend, we stink of my heat and your rut. It is only fitting that we wash it off." Sherlock stripped off all his vestments, while quite concealing the taut tenor of his soul, and what he was resolving to do, but he was resolved to do no less. They bathed the time, and he put off action by speaking of things that he knew. Also he could see his dear friend grant the extras of an open look of awe. Jean looked at Sherlock as if Sherlock were a crown prince, and the darling of the court, as he was a youngest prince, discarded. He did as he resolved, and having argued for some measure of Jean's love, he sat in his lap and slid Jean's staff between his legs, that he, like the roses, might grant extras. Of course, so generous was Jean's heart that his hand stroked Sherlock's staff in time, and they ended both in sweet release. When they were done and cleaned, in a sort of wonder, he heard Jean ask for Sherlock's favor. He took a red ribbon from his surcoat and bound it to the place where he thought he had the most chance of being remembered, for so surely had Jean captured his own memory. He made a knot and bow around where Jean's knot would be, and by the greedy feeling growing upon his heart, made Jean swear that only Sherlock could remove it. He could not have said in that moment that when he took the right turning path to the convent, that he'd give Jean leave for its remove. But he rather doubted it. At the next crossroads, he paused and wrestled with himself. He chose the leftward turning path. He reveled in being touched, and touching in return. Collegium egregium transmuted into something more by the simple smiles that Jean gave him, and inculcated within him a hunger for more. He was generous, because it made Jean smile at him. He did his best to shine as brilliantly as he could, so he could hear Jean's praise of him. Sherlock bargained with himself for time. He reasoned. He was most convincing. In convincing Jean, they so disported. He sank down upon Jean's staff and rode him well. Without the divine madness of heat, it were even sweeter to take his time with it, to look down and think, "This is my vassal. This is the one who has pledged himself to me, but only for a time." All the while, Jean played some melody by running fingers up and down Sherlock's ribs, which he could hear like the music of the spheres. It was a sort of paean for what they now did that rose in crescendo on Sherlock's cries. Jean was almost silent in his gasps. After Sherlock wrapped himself around Jean and felt the melody turn into a sort of elegy in a minor key, as he drowsed with Jean's fingers stroking in his hair, he said, "Tell me of the Emperor of the East Court in Constantinople." Jean told him of that glittering court and all its wonders. He spoke of boating parties that ventured upon the Black Sea. Sherlock did not ask if Jean had chanced to go as far as Thomas, upon that black sea, where the poet Ovid had died in exile. He did not ask if Jean had read Ovid's Herodotus, in which abandoned Omegas wrote to the heroes who had left them. For all the while he wondered if the time would ever come when Jean would reach for Sherlock, without Sherlock's importuning. But such was not the flow of their river. Ever Sherlock reached, ever Jean gave, as with most things in Sherlock's life. Love was something that could be withheld. For an example of this proof, although the pattern of it occurred more than once, there was an occasion when Sherlock questioned a simple villain about a spectral hound, for he much longed to see one, and vowed he would before he went to the convent. But what she'd seen was nothing more than a feral dog. He'd let his words fly, because that's what he had always done. Still, on turning, Jean's face was dark against him, as if he finally saw Sherlock's demon blood within his sanguine nature. That night, dear friend Jean slept apart for nothing. It was less than nothing. They were merely words. He applied other words. He applied every piece of rhetoric that he knew. Words hurt. He knew it, because he felt the blow as Jean said, "This night, I do not feel much inclined to be your friend." Sherlock did not give up. He could not give up. He had turned from the great work, his life's work, for this extra, fully knowing that every day he delayed would be weighed against him, both in his own eyes and that of the world. He could not lose what time he had, because he'd acted as the demon's child that he was. He talked until his voice died, and then he crept into Jean's bed, shivering. For surely, if he were cold, he would be taken in, only to be shoved aside with a blanket. He wanted no blanket. He was all filled with apprehension. All he had was this road in the woods, ever circling the place that he needs must go. Every day proclaimed it. His body was changing against him, as the alchemical process of life and death continued, and the idea of the life within him gained ever greater weight. Sherlock could not even leave the woods, not without going back to being a prince in a tower, or worse. This was the only place he could be with Jean and come to better know him. This road, this omnis mundi, the world road of heaven, which Sherlock knew to be the very dirt on which he traveled with Jean. Jean, who was free to set out from the forest. Jean, who, while Sherlock had been in his tower, had sailed to Constantinople. Jean, who had seen the Forum of Rome and the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Jean, whose face was thunder to him. For all Sherlock used words and pressed his body against Jean, Jean did not yield. Not even when Sherlock told Jean of his need for him. This gained him Jean sitting on his back in the dirt, while below he felt the swell of his body, which rather than concave, now rounded in reminder of what they had done together. Yet, in the end, it was easy. Sherlock apologized to a fool. He purchased extra days from Jean, and so some more favors of his love. Sherlock was the fool for keeping on this road, this omnis mundi. And yet, at the crossroads, he took the leftward turning path to once more prolong it. Along the way, his own reputation being no consideration, he now considered it lost ere that first heat it struck. He sought to retrieve Jean's own. When they helped a shepherd recover his prized stallion that had disappeared in a silver blaze, because a puka decided to sport with him, they were given shelter in a hayrick. The next morning, Sherlock told the shepherd, "I'm sorry if we broke your rest the last night, but I and my vassal were at such prayers that had me singing God's praises." The shepherd winked at him. "It is only right to sing God's praise." Sherlock whirled on Jean with a raised finger. "See, even this villain thinks that you should shout in praise of God when my lips are at your staff." Jean flushed and packed his courser that they might be on their way. As they left, he said, "Have you no care for your reputation?" Sherlock smiled at him, as coolly as if he had a chip of ice within his mouth. "An Omega is either ruined or not. There is no such thing as partial ruin, as there is no such thing as partially being bred, which now more than my scent proclaims we have done. I have concluded that I should revel in for that which I shall pay a price, and have long indeed have already paid. But you..." He reached over and brushed his fingers in dear friend John's flaxen hair. "When next you are flung from court for lacking generosity and love, you will have dozens that you may call upon as witness that it is not so. For the truth is that such is a lie, given that all you have done for me, it is the least of things that I could do for you."
"But I have ruined you." Jean looked stunned.
"Please, dear friend, give credit where it is due." Sherlock smiled, though he ached for Jean to reach out for him. "I requested your ruin of me. A true ruin, were we still in the tower, doing naught but coupling. Instead, by your presence, I am given license for this marvelous adventure."
Jean shook his head then. "Mystery, I've seen you call a puka to task and command his fairy master. I have never met anyone as learned as you. With all you see, you do not need my license for adventure."
Sherlock looked at his friend and felt the plant within him unfurl more leaves, for in John's eyes he saw it was so. Sherlock pulled his lute from his bag and set to softly strumming it as they went, well satisfied with his day.
The road with Jean was an illumination of possibility. It were Jean who, upon learning of a local festival celebrating St. Bridget, taught Sherlock to dance the brawl, which was enjoyable, and the pavane, which was dull. But no one looked askance at them at all. It was Jean who discerned that the witches in the Wilding Wood possessed many artifacts of interest, after Sherlock had dismissed their coven as slovenly a practice. It was Jean who heard the tale of a Yethhound, who was actually a Yethhound, from a band of raggle-taggle travelers, and helped cast the spell of holding that bound it back to the eldritch lands from which it came. Still well he knew, as his body changed as an ever-growing calendar, and the days turned from ever-lengthening to shortening their hours, their time together was drawing to a close. Still, wanting one day extra, he chose the leftward turning path. Fate, sitting round upon the sign of the crossroads, smiled to see them go. They came to a market town with a teeming marketplace. There, they were most assiduously greeted by the Countess Serpentine. Sherlock could see there was something amiss, for the masonry in the stones was far too even to be natural. But even as he examined the Countess Serpentine,
The answer eluded him. In truth, he was much distracted. Lurking in the aisles of the library of his mind, he had added a vision of a full, thick feather tick on a true bed. Furthermore, to his vision, he added a version of himself, pleasantly with Jean engaged. In this vision, they lay in the soft bed and did nothing but kiss and touch all the night through, granting no release until morning, and only then sleeping in this cloud of a bed. So thus distracted, he came to no conclusions from his observations. Full of courtesy, and having heard of their other adventures, the Countess Serpentine threw a tourney in their honor, much pleased with Sherlock for the opportunity to see Jean's skill in the lists, for seeing Jean such engaged, always engaged his interest. So distracted, he was forced to ask Countess Serpentine to repeat her questions. Thus chastened, he turned his attention to their conversation, which engaged on many subjects that were to his interests, including alchemy. That night, when it came time to feast, Jean was distant and would not sit next to him. When he left the feast early, Sherlock felt a chill that raised pebbles on his flesh, and he was quite uncertain what he'd done that was incorrect, and himself a demon's child proved. For well he knew Jean's habit of withdrawing his love when he felt that Sherlock had done aught amiss. Freshly determined to carry on with the great work when he could, he turned to the Countess Serpentine and engaged in further conversation. He accepted her invitation to see her library, which was vast, although still not as large as the library of the Magdalene that he'd furnished in his mind. Some hours they were in conversation, with the Countess oft suggesting that Sherlock should stay and study a while, and perhaps, once he'd been delivered, that they could further improve upon a friendship. Each time she said friendship, Sherlock knew well she meant that he should be a vassal to her, and in such service, he'd have little say in what road he traveled on. He was renewed once more, on thinking that Jean had gladly become Sherlock's vassal, rather than requiring the reverse, but then thought that perhaps Jean would not have desired such from him. So Sherlock each time to her suggestion said, "As I have said, my dear friend Jean and I journey together to the convent of the Magdalene, that having had my pleasure, I'll pay the price. Nothing shall turn me from my destination." Now, in addition to her importuning, there was something about the Countess that was quite off-putting. Sherlock took some care to put on his person a magic whip that he'd acquired from the witches in the Wilding Wood. That way, if the Countess continued to press her suit, he could hold her off with blows until his Jean came. If he would, finally, with a sigh, the Countess Serpentine summoned a servant, who whispered in her ear. She turned with a smile. "I am afeard that I have some sore news. I have learned that your vassal, of whose loyalty you have all this day extolled, is even now to you unfaithful. Perhaps you should take up with other friends." Sherlock scoffed. "Sir Jean would never be so." The Countess put her hand on his elbow. "The proof is in the seeing." The Countess Serpentine brought Sherlock to Jean's sleeping chamber, and there tried to accuse Jean of unfaithfulness, while a dubious beta clutched at Jean. Sherlock did not need to see the proof that his favor was still firmly tied to know that Jean was true. It was writ large upon his dear face that the beta that importuned him was unwanted. Then Jean cried out, "Serpentine, you are named, and like a serpent you are, for how else would the ruler of such an estate stoop to such trickery?" Sherlock was struck dumb for a moment by his friend's great brilliance, for he had easily divined what mystery had eluded Sherlock, and quite found the explanation. "My friend, you are not of great brilliance, but by your reflection you cast light." Sherlock raised his right hand. "Ostendo vestri ignavis." With these words, the false castle and town were made to disappear, and the truth revealed. They stood in a noxious cave, while Countess Serpentine and her hateful beta were transformed before their eyes into great serpents. Sherlock was not surprised. "I suspected aught was amiss when I saw the nature of your masonry, and by the quality of your books, but by Jean's words I knew." He looked on Jean as he said it, and by Jean's dear face, Sherlock knew he had once more amazed him. They set to battling serpents, and as they were together, they defeated them. It were most fine, but as they made their way away, Sherlock was deeply troubled by how long it had taken him to see the truth. When he thought back, the evidence had been all around them. When they made their rest that night, in an abandoned shepherd's cottage, as if the knot that held his emotions within him let way, and they flowed out, "What is it about you that I am so out of comport? I should have been to the convent months ago, but instead I meander with you on these pretty adventures. This day I should have seen what they were immediately, but instead my mind strayed to thoughts of being cleaved by you in a true bed, where all my thoughts once tended to mystery. Now I am forever upon thoughts of you. Then further still, I was distracted by your leave-taking." Sherlock gripped Jean. "You never reach for me, while I am always reaching for you." Jean laughed in a bitter sound. "I do not reach for courtesy's sake, that I might repay you the respect that once I failed to give you to your cost. Without that restraint, I'd be at you every moment for your embrace." "Then I hate your courtesy. We are bringing a life and a death into this world, and that is not a courteous thing at all." So saying, he took a kiss with no courtesy in it. They coupled fiercely, and while doing so, Sherlock bit his mark on John's neck, thinking, "Thus I claim him as mine." A mark that John then returned, and Sherlock welcomed the sting. After the storm passed them, Sherlock tenderly rubbed his salve into Jean's wounds, which Jean returned in an air of silent reverence. By the hand of primal love, though the marks healed, they left faint scars as the church causes with their anointed oil. Revelation, who was known as Sophia, by which name of wisdom would be a dark glass to my meaning, lifted the scales from Sherlock's eyes that he might see into mystery. It came to him then that his time with Jean, far from a turning away from the great work that required him to withdraw from the world for success, this time had been the fullest expression of the great work within the world that the work was meant to purify. He had every day been at the divination of truth with Jean, who was not himself brilliant. Yet, if God was the primal love that moved the sun and moon and stars,
How much meaning should Sherlock take from Jean, who'd lit a fire in the hearth, and always shone such a light on all their ventures? All in wonder, he said, I was going to the convent of the Magdalene, in Brosseliande, where I was to turn away from the world, the better to discern its mysteries. The vision of revelation tumbled through him as he rubbed against John. How could I have foreseen the path that I am now on? It is fortunate that I am well versed in philosophy, that I may face this turn of events. Sophia smiled upon him then, and laid her hand upon his brow. He spoke words then that weeks earlier, the plant in his heart, a mere seedling, would have been mere sophistic logic, but now he saw to be the truth. If God is love, and all other loves a reflection of that great love, it is but simple to deduce that by my granting my love to you, and you granting your love to me, we do nothing of mere dross, but something divine, and divinely required. What need have I of a convent, then, that already am in constant worship? Thinking then upon his fear of love's withdrawal, he made this request. As you see the logic of this, please, when I've done poorly, on account of the evil flowing from the hateful demon's blood that rendered me both man and omega, think on the divine mystery, and not the mere mortal one, and do not your love from me withhold. Jean sighed in Sherlock's arms. I do not know what you mean by demon's blood, for though I've heard this slander said, we do not believe it in Camelot. We know that Omega men are merely of a sanguine nature, which delights me greatly, to be so loved by so demanding a lord in love. Here, he touched Sherlock in a manner that fully expressed his delight. Well licensed to every misbehavior, I have no wish to grant. But still, I acknowledge that I am sometimes of a choleric temper, when our natures do collide. Please touch me on the mark that you've made, that we remember this, and so remember love. Jean laughed, and it was a wondrous sound. You already have my love, but it seems I needed such scholarship to teach me grant it. With Sophia speaking in his ears, Sherlock said, For all I can see, how did I not see that it was so? For much my fear of its lack has been my torment, and ever I turned us leftward, to give myself more time to love and gender. Now like Saul reaching Damascus, the scales are lifted from my blindness, and I see your love as shown from your every action. As was meet in his studies, understanding gave way to practical application. So he spent the night loving his love, and fell asleep tangled with him. The Romance of Mystery, Book 2, Chapter 5. He was still tangled in love when Mycroft found them, and his knights callously pulled them apart. He and his brother made their arguments, but Mycroft would not be moved. Even when faced with the sure evidence of Sherlock's body and the report of Sherlock's open disporting across the countryside, his brother only sniffed and murmured in Sherlock's ear, Please, believe, brother, that by the time I finish my discussion with your betrothed, I'll have him thinking your behavior a richest lace that may only increase his prestige to bring errant knights to his court. Sherlock gifted Mycroft with a look of scorn. What, that all will sigh at his good fortune, at having bonded with one who is a prince in the parlor, but in the bedchamber is quite transformed like to a wild leopard? Mycroft raised his eyebrows.
Even so, when I am done, he'll see all others are mere kittens. Sherlock would have exchanged more words, but then Sherlock saw a way out of this dilemma.
Bring the alpha that you wish me to bond before me. I assure you, I shall turn from him, but without a word or shameful act from me, and all words of your own craft set to making him agree to our bond. He will from me run away. If this occurs, as I have laid it down, you will apply your craft to getting father's permission to leave me to choose as I will, with no dower settlement required, but that of John's person. The alpha you will meet, and in so doing will see the benefit of this path.
Then Mycroft, with his expression full of the craft he had,
but I will take your wager, if your craft you so prove, and yet knowing your ways, I shall withhold the question of settlement, that you do not do yourself out of what you are owed for your worth.
They shook on it, and swore to God it would be so. On seeing the fear in John's face, Sherlock winked at him and said, "Take heart, and trust in me." They journeyed to the convent of the Magdalene, deep in the valley that lay at the heart of Broceliande. For there, Mycroft was determined that Sherlock would wait out the months of his confinement. It was only as the gates closed loud behind them that Mycroft said, "Welcome, brother. What I had not said ere now is that I endowed this convent, and the orphanage to it attached, with our brothers set on peopling a country with their rutting. It has been a necessity. Never would I have thought that you'd make your own donation."
Sherlock sniffed at his brother. "The years have made you fat, which has quite clouded your eyes and judgment. I'll not be adding a foundling to the orphanage's coffers, but rather will keep my child."
Mycroft smiled as if parrying a blow. "Dear brother, you've not had a chance to think things through. You've been so bent on adventure. Consider how then you would live upon the road with your errant knight, and by what way purchase food, much less books for alchemy, which I have been the one to provide you. As the truth of your situation bears you down, we'll see what you would choose. For my part, I will gladly dower your child myself, to be fostered by our uncle in Rome, that in the center of learning and power, the child will grow to prestige within the church."
Sherlock would have called Mycroft other names then, but allowed himself to be guided through the grounds. So it was that finally Sherlock went to see the convent's library, and it was small. It was nothing like the library he held in his mind. Instead, its books were few, and not of any use. But it did not matter. He had within himself the other library, the one he'd been building since he was 9. There he had all the books he needed. Now, it was not Mycroft's plan to send for the Prince of Gore until Sherlock had been delivered, but word came to them just as they arrived that the prince was on his way, having heard his betrothed was there. This did not put either brother in a panic, for each was sure of his own wits. Sherlock was forced to make good use of his time. He consulted Jabir's work on the theory of corpusculinarianism, which spoke of the way a body's outer and inner self was possessed of minute particles. If the basic properties of those elements for hotness, coldness, dryness, and moistness were to be rearranged by the application of certain corresponding elements within an elixir, that body might be transformed into another shape. He carefully studied the numerology of the needed elements, and he brewed such an elixir that he might implement his plan. No matter what Mycroft said of logic, he did not waver in his determination.
Each day, Sherlock went to walk upon the walls, and on seeing Jean, waiting in vigil beyond them, he was greatly heartened and much resolved to his plan. In this, Mycroft did much to offend him, knowing that the Prince of Gore was headed their way. He was forced to remain at the convent, and in waiting, he harried Sherlock every day with false logic. There was one day that Mycroft kept him entirely from his walk upon the walls. Instead, he spoke for hours on the benefits of bonding with a king's second son, who was his favorite. He spoke long on the potential fall of Sherlock's position and the potential for pathos. He, with logic, pointed out that Sherlock had no land settled on him, and now never would. On the road, there'd be no books or finery or betas to care for what child he bore. He spoke on the pride of their kingdom to be restored, and appealed to Sherlock's ethos. He spoke on the folly of any other option but what bond Mycroft had set before him, or if disdaining thus, they could set to market in farther lands. Sherlock was restless all the while, until finally he cried out, "The more you go on about my prospects, the more I think jealousy moves you, that you cannot so market yourself. My path to rule is a harder road than what faces you, but things that are difficult are the ones worth doing." For a moment they smiled at one another, almost as if hatred didn't rise like a black bile in Sherlock's heart for his brother. And then he remembered himself and took himself to bed for illness. So on the next day, he rushed to see his Jean. But though he searched for Jean from his perch upon the wall, there was no one waiting in vigil beyond. After days passed, and still no Jean, Mycroft said, "It seems pleasure done. You've been abandoned. See sense now, and this mongrel child give away. Take the match that you've been given. Even now, as you are, it's no certain thing, but you've the wits to bend this prince to your will, and with some advice I can give, you could make him crown prince, and then to king. A consort king you'd be, and rule that which you could then expand, perhaps one day even to be consort to the high king. A far better fate than wandering roads with some errant knight." Sherlock closed his eyes and thought about the Countess Serpentine, and how she'd tried to trick him into thinking that Jean had forsaken him. "I'll never choose the alpha you've chosen. We will see." Now, the Prince of Gore came with a great troop of knights, each ever more resplendent, for thereby that house gained its name of Moriarty, which in the local tongue means more art. Now Sherlock was dressed with great care, in such a way that it quite concealed his shame, and the color that the sun had painted on his cheeks, by art they then unpainted. But word had spread of Sherlock's actions to the Prince of Gore's ears, as it seemed his agents quite matched Mycroft's own. Mycroft's care was for naught. Now the Prince of Gore, Prince James as he was called, on seeing Sherlock's state, in an almost teasing way said,
"Though I've signed the betrothal, it seemed my love's somewhat in a trammelled state. I think I should pay but half the agreed-upon dowry to be settled upon him." Mycroft was unmoved by this. At the agreed-upon dower settlement, or not at all. In truth, this is a blessing, for now you've proof that my brother is fastened, while before you had naught but hope. Now we merely have but to wait and let this exigency pass, and go on as we were before, with improved goods. Prince James smiled, a most peculiar smile. His reputation is in tatters. For all the countryside, they speak of him and his behavior. As 'tis true, then at a quarter of his dower settlement, and I am generous. Mycroft gave forth a gusty smile, put out the word that it was another, for it was not by his own name that he so disported, or wear it as a tattered benefit. Here again Prince James smiled, his most peculiar smile. You are quite right, a marvelously tattered benefit. From the first, Prince Sherlock has piqued my interest. When I heard he came of demonic coupling, his evil blood answered to the evil in my own heart and made me want him. He pealed forth a high laugh. When I found that he needed to be locked up in a tower for his heated, sanguine behavior, that made you engage in covertsy at the papal court and so introduce practices that will cause more sin to spread, I came to desire him even more. My love is such that he spreads evil in the world by his mere presence in the world. Here Sherlock dearly wished to say something, but as his wager depended on his silence, he said not. Instead, he smiled most unpleasantly at his brother, for this betrothal was his idea. Now there had been nothing in the Prince of Gore's reputation to indicate he'd say such things. Mycroft essayed an exploratory remark. Sherlock's dispensation is in keeping with the acts of old. Well, the room that burned, yes. Prince James made to walk around Sherlock now. That were then, when I merely wanted him, that we might couple, and then I'd break him when I found him as dull and as ordinary as all are. But now to find that through alchemy he escaped his tower, and these long months has engaged in dangerous magic, will openly couplin' in the countryside, for all to see. Now I see he is no ordinary Omega, but my perfect match. He leaned quite close and breathed deeply of Sherlock's scent. What say you, love? All those years spent in sharpening the blade of yourself in your tower, because the world was too small for you, and so sought to keep you small. Let's slit the world from groin to throat, to split it open, and make it large enough for us both. With your magic and my arts, we shall lay the seeds of war and ruin. Come, love, show me your dark arts. Here Sherlock's eyes grew wide, for there was a strange beguilement in Prince James's tone, and his voice was almost like singing. If Sherlock were but days released from his tower, he'd have stepped towards that tone. He thanked the Lord God above for his months on the road. As his wager was that he'd say no words, he should say nothing. But he could not keep the words back. I studied my arts that I might bring light into the world. Yes, you are right. A fire is a light. He laid his hand upon Sherlock's then. And to Sherlock's great dismay, he felt the same sense of rightness that he'd long ago recognized with Jean. He knew then that Prince James was, just as John was, a collegium egregium to him. When you are my bonded maid, what will we not do? Shall we pour slow poison in all the courts? He gazed upon Sherlock's face. No, I see by your expression that would be a dullard's act. No, my love, you are right to think of fire. We'll set fire to all, and when all are dead, be high king and consort king over a mound of ashes. Sherlock felt that touch and the sense of wrong rightness that it brought. He saw then, as if it had occurred, that had he not left his tower, sharply honed from years of loneliness, and feeling that touch without knowing John's, he might well have agreed to bond. He saw himself encouraged in dark mystery and bound by a different knot. He felt the crown of Gore upon his brow. He breathed in the smoke of that life. He could taste the ashes of that fate in his mouth.
Primal love,
on Sherlock's right, laid his hand upon Sherlock's shoulder. "Do not fear. Had such been your choice, to the court of Gore I would have Jean directed, and given you a chance to choose again." His fate, well fessoned with the child of choice, smiled broadly, for he'd never consume those ashes, and leaned back into Choice's arms, and gave her a kiss and thanks. Revelation, whose name is Sophia, standing on Sherlock's left, placed her hand upon Sherlock's shoulder. "Do not fear, even though your heart had been seeded with naught but weeds, and your ears stopped with wax. You heard my urging, and chose the path that led you here. Choice, for good or ill, once urged Eve to eat a fruit because it was wise, set firm behind Sherlock's fate, with the assurance that he need never be gripped by a blood-stained crown of iron barbs, were he but to choose that it not be so. The Prince of Peace, standing behind Sherlock, laid his hand upon his heart. "Do not fear, for we are with you, and ever have been." So encouraged, Sherlock reclaimed his hand from Prince James, and though words were forbidden by his wager, he did not suppress them.
"I stand on the side of angels, though I am not of the angels." Prince James gave way to peals of laughter. "As Lucifer was an angel, I agree. I stand with angels as well, with burning pride in their hearts, for I see the fire in you, as it burns in me. The evil in my heart calls to the demon blood that flows in your veins. Here, my love, and you might feel it." He brushed his fingers across Sherlock's cheek in a knowing mockery of John's gesture so many months ago. Sherlock did not sway into that touch, for he had primal love standing by him upon his right, Holy Sophia standing by him upon his left, and the Prince of Peace with his hand upon his heart. Demon's blood, it may be true, but I've found that the world has too much interest in it to set it dumbly on fire. Now Mycroft, observing all of this, said, "Prince James, your words give me pause, and this bond of which you speak is not yet a done thing. Now that I think on it, I did not properly study your family history to see that you are not closely related to our line. You may be too close a cousin to our family tree for bond to be allowed. And if not, then such a cousin will be found." Prince James clapped. "Now in lawyerin' I see you wrigglin'. But there's naught you can do which is most delicious, like a subtlety, shaped like a most cunning castle, that on being pierced lets forth a murder of crows. It is why I've revealed my nature that by my actions I've long concealed." Prince James spun on his toes as if to fly. "If you break the betrothal that your father signed, then 'tis you who are in the wrong. So I, within my rights, can march on Logris, setting fire to all with my liege Arthur's own blessing, and take my promised Omega. Even better, this will be such a revel." Mycroft turned to Sherlock then, with a look possibly intended to calm him, but Sherlock was not in good humor with him. With Holy Sophia and primal love and the Prince of Peace offering comfort, Sherlock lifted the vial he to this meeting brought, and with care prepared. He quaffed it down, and felt it make its bitter effects, as from human form he shed, and a black leopard he became, with snarling teeth and mighty claws. Now, Sherlock should have known it, for he'd studied it, but such magics are capricious, when shifting from one nature to another. Nature is not always forgiving. As this was what he'd chosen by his elixir, nature took from Sherlock the mind she'd given, and set a leopard's ways on him. Sherlock's plan, that when the Prince of Gore saw him in this aspect, he'd run away. Instead, Prince James clapped and cheered aloud. "You are beautiful. Thank you for showing me your darkest arts." Now, had Sherlock been of the mind nature first gave him, this might have given him pause. But in that moment, Sherlock had a leopard's mind and ways, so he simply leapt upon Prince James and killed him. Sherlock heard, but did not understand Mycroft say, "Brother, it is good to see that when you do a thing, you do it most thoroughly. But I beg that you cease eating your former betrothed. It cannot be good for you." Sherlock looked up from his feast and snarled at his brother, who waited in perfect calm. They gazed at each other for a time until, growling, Sherlock ran from the room. He went up the convent walls and leaped quite over them, leaving Mycroft to arrange for the Prince of Gore's corpse to be artfully arranged in the spot where Jean had once held his vigils, as Mycroft did enjoy irony. He let it be known to Prince James' gathered knights that the Prince of Gore, on seeing his betrothed so trammeled, had gone to walk alone outside the convent walls to think. Though this had been against Mycroft's advice, Mycroft instructed them that if they might wish to find their lord and master, that he could be kept safe, and then waited for that prince to be found in his much mauled state. On this, Sherlock did not care. In that moment, he only cared to run away as far as he could. In the woods, Sherlock lived as an animal would. He lived on meat that he caught and quite forgot that he wore another shape. By some instinct, he made his way to a cave, and in his time delivered himself of his kit. Though he was a beast in understanding, still he loved his kit, with all the fierce heat that a leopard's heart may hold, and cared for him as well he could. He'd hide the kit in a thorn thicket so that he could hunt and hurry back with his kills. When a bear threatened the bramble, it was the bear that backed down, before Sherlock's snarl. Now, from their lives, he knew there was aught that was missing, but with a beast's understanding, he knew not what. Carrying his kit, he roamed the forest, ever looking for what had been lost. One day, upon his journey, he chanced to lay upon a doughty branch, grooming his kit. Looking out distant on a hill, he saw Jean. Primal love had all this time patiently waited for this moment that he might return Sherlock's mind to himself and know his love when he saw him. To his astonishment, Sherlock came to himself in leopard shape. Sherlock opened his mouth then to speak the words that would reverse what he'd done, but from his mouth only came a beast's dumb cry. He tried again, and with greater will, to no better effect. His kit mewed for his mother to resume his licking, so with no better answer, he finished his child's rough bath and considered his next best action. It came to him that he must rejoin with Jean, so picking up his kit, he ran all in haste, blundering through the woods where he'd last seen his love.
Romance of Mystery, Book 2,
Chapter 6. He ran quickly forward. He did not hesitate, but he ran so quickly he ran into a trap. A snare snapped around his foot, and the knot that held him trapped him quite tight. He despaired out loud, but that despair was spoken as a beast's moan. Then, to his great joy, Jean appeared. Although by his aspect he was quite changed, with filthy locks and unshaven hair, all dressed in tattered animal skins. Jean said, "Fear not, I will free you." With quick fingers, he freed Sherlock from the snare's knot. Sherlock purred and rubbed all his body against Jean's legs to let him know that Sherlock, even thus changed, was overjoyed to see him. Jean picked up his child, who scrubbed Jean's face with happy licking. Jean laughed, and to Sherlock it was like the sound of home. But, as Jean smiled down at him, Sherlock saw no recognition in his eyes, and realized that Jean did not know him. He tried his best. He butted his head under Jean's hands so that Jean's fingers would rest upon the golden collar that he'd long seen Sherlock wear. as this made no change. Sherlock was forced to admit that though his love was true, he was not always great in observation.
Nature nodded in agreement. That is true. Although, I'll grant that when people choose to throw off the shapes that I give them, they might wish for a better plan for putting them back on. She wagged a finger at Nurture. My blame lies on you, for not seeing Omega's better taught tactics and strategy. Nurture said, Given the care his brother Mycroft took to teach exactly such skills long ignored, you've not much argument to make. This my proof. I still hold they don't need it, as it is their lot to brood in the inner circle of the home, while alphas by their nature defend, while betas shuttle between the two to tend to all. Nurture moved her pawn and said, I'll soon have you in checkmate. Nature smiled and did not agree with that assessment.
While on the floor, Jean commenced with petting Sherlock, and it felt so good to simply be touched. Sherlock quite gave way with great purring. When it came time to go to sleep, Sherlock waited for Jean to lie down and then sprawled over him, taking what meager comfort he could. Jean murmured, Christ above, you're heavy! But didn't shove him off, but rather allowed Kit to curl likewise at his feet. In the morning, Jean began to speak of mystery, which confused Sherlock some in his half-sleeping state, until he realized that Jean spoke of him, and how Jean wished he'd spoken often to his love before love died. He knew then that Mycroft had with craft misled Jean into thinking Sherlock was dead, and he cursed his brother anew. Sherlock comforted John as well he could by roughly licking his face. He would have licked further down, but John laughed and pushed him off the bed, saying, No, I don't need cleaning there, but thank you. Sherlock would have disagreed, but he had no words with which to sway John. And in his present shape, even with his great powers of rhetoric, he could not allow for a way to take up as they'd been before. It also came to him that even if Jean knew that Sherlock was in leopard's form, there was nothing he could do about it. Sherlock had never told him the words to say that would change back Sherlock and their child to human shape. He allowed that perhaps he should have shared certain aspects of his plan. So they lived in the forest for a time. Sherlock delighted in killing deer and bringing them to Jean as meaty presents. He taught their kit what he could, which was much on pouncing. He delighted in seeing Kit practice pounces with John. After a time, he saw sorrow somewhat lift from John's face. John shaved his jaw and cut his hair, and then from that place they turned on the rightward path to the court of Camelot. Sherlock was careful not to give way to a leopard's behavior, but instead unpresented to High King Arthur and High Queen Guinevere, bowed as the son of a king should bow before the High King and High Queen of all the Britons. The court clapped, but none cried out the answer or the word that would free them of this shape. While it gladdened him to see Jean of happier mien, still the thought of Jean forming a bond with another plagued his thoughts. Sherlock had lost the words to argue for his love. So it was that when a fair Omega chanced to smile on John over a bowl of cabbage soup, and John smiled back in return, hot jealousy whispered in Sherlock's ear that he should not stand for it, for all primal love told him that his jealousy was without seat. He ran up to the ladies' chambers and sprayed his scent markings on all the room, then did the same with all of John's belongings. Even as he did it, he knew it was wrong, but lacking words, he gave way to action. Jean remonstrated him for his poor behavior. As he could not answer back, Sherlock hid his face in his belly and sadly licked himself. He looked up at Jean to gauge his anger. Jean shoved his clothing in Sherlock's face and delivered 10 blows to Sherlock's backside. Sherlock cried out Jean's name, but the words he spoke were a beast's dumb cries. He rubbed his body against Jean's legs, that what little he had not be taken from him. It must be admitted, he also did it to further mark him with Sherlock's scent. He moaned his arguments that Jean loved him. He mewed that Jean knew that sometimes Sherlock behaved badly. But to forgive was divine, and did not Jean want to reach towards divinity? He meowed that they had a kit together, who was even now playing after a spot of light upon the floor. Jean could not understand him, and nevermore had Sherlock missed speech, as Jean shoved him away, saying, "No!" in a hard voice. He could not stand it, and so he stood as best he could upon his hind legs, that he might lick the spot where once he'd marked Jean, hoping that somehow Jean would finally understand. It seemed he did, as his face quite transformed. Jean said, "How could I forget that where once I from my love withheld, thinking to engender better behavior, I both caused him pain and got no good result of it." Jean wrapped his arms around Sherlock, kneeling there on the floor. "I'll not withhold my love again, but still," he tapped his finger on Sherlock's nose, "I'll not truck with such poor behavior." Sherlock sulked at this, but found himself, with primal love's gaze upon him, wishing to do somewhat better, as Jean smiled at every omega at court. Though jealousy whispered in Sherlock's ears, he twitched them back and did not listen. Instead, at night, he happily rested his head on Jean's heart and listened to its drumbeat. Sherlock liked it best when they weren't on quests, by which he still sought to bring the purity of truth, which was the nature of the great work, to the world, although it were a vastly different experience from his experience before, as the ocean is different from a forest, and an oak is different from an eagle. He had his eyes and wits, but without the power of speech, he had no way to communicate what he wished to know or what he knew. To him in this shape, even that he was one who'd know such things. When the giant of Cerne Abbas climbed down from his mountain, Sherlock knew the answers to his riddles that would turn him back to a chalk outline again, but could not speak them. In the end, he mostly watched as Sir Gawain thought to get the giant drunk on an enormous keg of ale, and in this state the giant rutted in a cave that Sir Silence, who was an omega pretending to be an alpha, anointed with certain perfumes that smelled like an omega in heat. The giant in that rut knotted himself to the cave, and there trapped himself, sick from drinking and sore. The giant readily agreed to become a chalk outline once more. Even in quests, where Sherlock led the way to the resolution, they could not end with him in preening explanation to gain Jean's admiring gaze, with a further reward of extras as they coupled together. Sherlock was a leopard, not a man. He was also not a peacock. Quests ended with a village saved, or a truth revealed, and no more. When they were part of a company that took the high white road by the light of the full moon, to face a dread pack of Garwath, who were part men and wolf, the reward was the road being free of fear. After they were done, none praised him, nor shunned him. He was simply one of many. Although he disdained Sir Yvonne's lion, which sought unwanted liberties, with a sniff he let the lion know his thought, and curled up at Jean's side as their company raised cups in celebration of their victory. When they found a stolen prince, kidnapped by his elder Bader brother of a sinister bar, Sherlock watched the Kit play with the boy. Kit blinked with the eyes of blue like John's, but not like John's, as they cat-eyed were, and Sherlock sighed over them both.
So it was as he wandered, even when they were not on quests. He got into places where he shouldn't go, and discovered many things. One day, as he tested Kit's ability at hide-and-seek, Sherlock was hidden beneath a low-covered table in a bower. He chanced to hear the omegas and betas chattering on about this or that. Sir Silence, with her gender now revealed, had been endowed Countess Silence, with her friend Lady Lunette, wished to speak of trade ships carrying spice and silk. This led to Lady Elaine speaking on the subject of harvest festivals. This bored Sherlock, but he was deeply committed to his hiding spot, and Kit was near to finding him. Baroness Assault of the White Hands wished to speak of other sort of harvests, and they fell to comparing their vassals in love. On this, the Countess Silence was silent, as she'd sworn to take no other vassal than her friend Lady Lunette, and as there was no benefit of an Omega Countess taking up a Lady Beta, they could be naught but the best of friends. Sherlock very much wished Kit would find him before he was forced to claw his own ears from his head. But, as Baroness Assault of the White Hands had captured Kit's attention with a ribbon, he had long to wait. Now into this discussion of vassals, Sir John's name came up. The visiting Queen Morgause said he seemed comely enough, which made Sherlock smile, for he'd prefer such a high lady to have such a tepid thought. But he was less pleased to hear Baroness Assault of the White Hand say, for all the good it would do you, he's well enough in the lists, but as we well know from the Lady Vert, he cannot perform his other duties, and a lady or lord is ill-served that only finds service in the lists. Here, Baroness Assault of the White Hands waved her little white finger. There was some laughter at this remark, but Lord Palamedes said, I thought I had heard Sir John had lost a love of a handsome prince of high estate, by whose loss to death, which even love may not resist, he then went mad for love's sake. Baroness Assault of the White Hands replied with further laughter, ha, 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 as if such a lowly knight could capture the interest of a prince. I'd heard it said he fell into rude company of some villain Omega, fessened of another lover, and failing even then was abandoned for a better protector. I think Sir John uses such stories as a blind, so he need not expose his failings. Here, Baroness Assault of the White Hands waved her little white finger. Now what then occurred were three things. Before Sherlock could leap out, as he was somewhat tangled beneath the table, Kit chanced to bite the white hands that trailed the ribbon before him, and was dropped to the ground, where he spotted his mother with a happy cry, which quite prevented Sherlock from doing much, as Kit was much in his way and wanted comfort. Countess Silence struck Baroness Assault of the White Hands such a blow as she overtoppled from her seat, while the Lady Lunette said, I'll hear no more of this discussion, whether rumor has overblown the rank of Sir John's lost love. I know he's been naught but kind, and grieves for his lost love, truly. He holds to his memory in a courteous manner, knowing they can only be rejoined in the grave. She took the hand of her friend Countess Silence, although whether this was to give pause to violence or comfort cannot be said. Baroness Assault of the White Hands wiped the blood from her lips and said, I still hold it were a Doxy Omega bred by another, and Sir John even made this Doxy to accompany him, that he might improve his reputation. A third time, Baroness Assault of the White Hands waved her little white finger. The Countess Silence handed her glove to the Baroness to indicate her willingness to meet any she wished as her champion in the lists, that this matter might be settled. Now, as the Countess Silence had been revealed to be an Omega, though she'd been raised as an Alpha, this was not quite neat. Still, the Baroness Assault of the White Hands agreed that her several champions would meet the Countess in the lists, and there show the Countess Silence the error of striking Baroness Assault of the White Hands. So it was there was a quick tourney arranged, although none would tell the champions over what they fought. The Countess Silence knocked them each down, and most courteously waited in silence for the Baroness to remove her opinion, which was only stated as, "I spoke poorly." Sherlock saw none of this, as he'd been busy seeing the Baroness Assault of the White Hands. Failure to pay her proper knight's fees to the court was being known by overturning certain chambers in the Exchequer. But he heard about it as the Lady Lunette praised Countess Silence in the outer courtyard with much soft kisses in a hidden niche that lay therein. As from then, not much in the mood for Bowers, he prowled in the fields when the Lady Vert, her lord and her confessor, returned to the court of Camelot.
He was crawling in a field to see what he could of the types of earth, when he saw the lady's confessor likewise prowl among the Omega villains working in the field. The lady's confessor had his teeth whitely bared as he spoke with this or that Omega, who like a herd of deer milled closer together to get away from the wolf that prowled among them. Sherlock stood up and coughed. The Omegas then clustered all around him, which was somewhat to his annoyance. But at Sherlock's wide yawn, the lady's confessor left most quickly. After this, the villains had much to say about how his behavior was not much like that of a Beta priest. In fact, they'd heard rumors that he'd by some magic brought Omegas unwilling to their heat, and thereby rutted with them, and gotten many an Omega with child. Furthermore, he'd returned when the Omega had birthed their shame, and taken the child for some devilish sort of ritual. Sherlock sniffed his disdain at their dissembling of the facts, which he was certain had a simpler explanation. He followed a stripling boy, who'd been much quiet through all of that talk. By purring and waiting, he cozened a sort of confession. The boy whispered that the Lady Vert had offered her confessor to sit with him in prayer during his time of heat, that he might stay from sinning. So rather than go to the village's house of heat to be watched over by other Omegas, he'd gone to the place the confessor had set. But that confessor did much more than prayer. When the stripling, to his shame, begged to be rutted, the confessor had said the stripling's demon's blood, which came of being a boy and an Omega, caused a Beta such as he to grow an Alpha's knot, and so quicken him. To my shame, I concealed all. I gave him the child of that shame, for who would have believed me? Revelation, who is sometimes called Holy Sophia, which but implies my meaning, rested her hand upon Sherlock's head, and lifted a veil from within his mind. He saw then that the plant that grew on his heart was rich with fruit. Far more than for just simply Kit or Jean, he saw that all his adventures had been extras like the rose, which gave goodness for the sake of goodness. He saw that an eagle can be like an oak, if seen in a certain way, and that a forest has some similarities to a sea. Now, without John watching, so he might see Sherlock doing well, Sherlock rubbed against the stripling's legs to mark him as being under Sherlock's aegis, and purred until it seemed the boy understood. primal love, who had been watching all this while, looked to Holy Sophia and said, "It is good."
The Romance of Mystery, Book 2, Chapter 7. It was with these revelations that the Lady Verte was much on Sherlock's mind when she came upon Jean, less to importune than to taunt him that she could ruin him again. Hearing her hateful words, anger whispered in Sherlock's ear, and he took his advice, with a sweep of his claw to let the hateful Omega know that Sherlock's Jean was not to be so trifled with. He'd have done more, but Jean held him back. When anger had left, he was quite struck with fear that he had done aught wrong again. But John simply knelt and embraced him, quite allowing Sherlock's comforting licks to his face. John picked up their child, who was examining an empty box, and held him, until Kit knew that he needed to be back at the box. That night, all around them the bachelor knights slept on their pallets, as if there was nothing strange or unusual in the world. Sir Gawain snored. Sir Kay made a sort of hum, while Sir Eric had very sweet dreams indeed, if his movements were any indication. Jean did not sleep. He lay as if he would, but his hand moved in ceaseless motion upon their child, held up against his heart. Sherlock, curled up at the foot of the bed, watched this all the night long. Now the next day, Sherlock was quite on guard, but nothing occurred until they came to the evening's feast. This was to be in honor of the return of Merlin, who, as it happened, was off from court, and by some fateful turn, his comings and goings mirrored Sherlock's and John's, such that when they were absent from court, he was there, and when he was back, they were out of it. Somewhat to Sherlock's astonishment, when Lady Verte accused Sherlock of his raking her with his claws, and cried out that the court should be rid of him, Merlin, an Omega man of some youth, stood up and laughed. Then he easily cast aside several enchantments at once. The first of these was that Sherlock and Kit were returned to human shape, and thus to Jean's arms. Sherlock was careful to be as clear as he could when he addressed the court, so that those who placed importance on Sherlock's estate knew of it, and those who placed importance on John's skills beyond the lists heard of it. While doing so, he gave them all such a look as they would understand that John was entirely Sherlock's, and now that he had words again, he'd defend what was his. Far from standing against their bond, on hearing of the blessing primal love had set upon what nature had joined, High Queen Guinevere vowed that the court of Camelot would grant John sufficient station to pay Sherlock's dowered settlement, and as they'd already had a child out of bond, they must now pay the price. How doing as he wished was a price to pay, Sherlock could not quite divine. But he decided that he cared not a whit, as long as Jean was acknowledged his. The second was that the Lady Verte was revealed as no Omega, but a Beta, who by a spell pretended to be an Omega, that by bond to Lord Verte she might rise to wealthy estate. For though she had been given much beauty, her presentation as a Beta would have confounded such a clime, until she found the magics to wear an Omega's scent, but without an Omega's generative power. By further spells, she'd convinced Lord Verte that in heat he had rutted with her. Now Sherlock knew full well that no alchemist that yet lived knew a spell to create life outside of rutting, and yet she'd firmed her position by her seeming birthing of children. The third was that this false lady's confessor was revealed as an Alpha, who by a spell pretended to be a Beta, that he might lull Omegas into thinking themselves safe in his company. The mystery of this supposed Beta, who got Omegas with child, with which he then absconded, was made clear by seeing the confessor stand next to Lord Vert's supposed children, which were the confessor's own. Sherlock was in a race to reveal all this, for even as he spoke, Merlin revealed it too. It was astonishing to hear his own observations made clear from another voice, and one that, unlike his brother, did not move to correct him. Rather, the voice of another Omega man, who was like and unlike himself. When he remarked on it later, Merlin laughed again, for he was full of laughter, and said, "It may be that it is our demon's blood that makes us clever as well as Omega men." Though by his wink, he made it clear that he believed no such thing. Sherlock, snugged firmly in John's arm, said, "That would be true, but my elder brother has even greater skills, but that he uses them in political machinations, and by his hubris causes no end to troubles." On his words, John said, "No, my lord, it must be true that such had a part in your crafting. For a moment, it was as if love had turned against him." But then John continued, "For as a demon is but an angel fallen, and why else would an angel alight to earth but for love?" He lightly brushed his hand across Sherlock's cheek. "If such were so, the only sure way to prove your angelic nature would be by bestowing on your poor vassal a kiss of your lips. The greater love you give, the more angelic you be proved." Sherlock looked down, all astonished, for previous to this, all importuning it had been at Sherlock's behest, but he granted request and was thus answered, "There you see, angelic without argument. For by your kiss, I already hope to find myself pressed against heaven's gate." He lowered his voice and whispered in Sherlock's ear, "If you grant me another kiss, I know you'll meet me in the solar when all are at feasting this night, to test that I've the key that is made to open that heavenly gate." Once more, Sherlock was all astonished, for previous to this, Jean had never suggested their couplings, and had even sought to avoid overt displays of affection before others. So Sherlock kissed him again, to let him know he was in agreement with this test. But even with so much sweet in his life, Sherlock turned to Merlin to ask, "What will come of the Lady Vert and her confessor?" Merlin mused upon it. "The Lord Vert has already been made to withdraw to a monastery in great shame, airless as he was revealed. I convinced him to dower each of the villain Omegas, whose fields had been so gleaned. Mistress Hudson, that bore his supposed eldest son, is a goodly widow, and has much organized the rest. It sorrows me to say that there were more attempts than the 7 claimed children might imply, as not all breeding led to successful births." Still thinking somewhat on his revelation, with Holy Sophia and Primal Love smiling upon him, Sherlock decided then and there to offer a place in his new household to the Omega villains so trammeled. As it came to pass, Mistress Hudson proved far better at organizing his household than he could ever have been, so he was amply rewarded, while the stripling boy, Billy, and his babe, Wiggins, proved of some assistance on a later adventure, which saw Billy settled with a miller, who treated with him kindly. Sherlock had but first proposed the idea of these additions to their household, once their bond could be made, when Jean said in a choleric manner, "It is a grave sin that Lady Vert and her confessor have committed, for this was not in the heat of passion, but of mindful purpose that these things have been done. If justice were to balance, they should be made to see the error of what they have done, and the pain that they have brought." John, as always, shone his light on the issue. Sherlock looked to Merlin, and saw that he had much the same idea as was cast by the light of John's words.
So after the High King and High Queen did their part, and stripped the lady of her title and the confessor of his false robes, Sherlock and Merlin set to the great work. The former Lady Vert and the former confessor were transformed, the former Lady Vert into an Omega Doe, and her former confessor into an Alpha Buck, who quickly fled into the woods. When the rut came upon them, they coupled in the wild. The former Lady Vert bore a fawn. So once delivered, they returned, and were to human shape transformed. But on being compelled to express their true thoughts, expressed no regrets to those they had sinned against, and only curses, and boasts upon the former confessor's part, to have enjoyed all he'd done, and would do again. They were transformed again. The former Lady Vert into an Alpha Boar, and her former confessor into an Omega Sow. They quickly fled into the woods. When the rut came upon them, they coupled. In the wild, the former confessor bore 3 piglets. So once delivered, they returned, and were to human shape transformed. But on being compelled to express their true thoughts, they expressed no regrets, but only curses. Thence they were transformed again, the former Lady Vert into an Omega Wolf, and her former confessor into her Alpha Mate. There in the forest, when their time came upon them, they coupled, and from thence the former Lady Vert bore a pup. So once delivered, they returned, and were to human shape transformed, with the compulsion to speak the truth upon them, when faced with those they'd sinned against, and knowing that before them lay the fate of Queen and Tomcat. The former Lady Vert and the former confessor were much chastened, and asked for mercy. This mercy was duly granted. The former Lady Vert was sent to the convent of the Magdalene in Broceliande, for as she'd played at being an Omega, so she was made in truth. The former confessor, who'd played at being a Beta, was so made in truth as well. He became a hermit and lived in Jean's former hovel in the woods, where he was much watched over by certain fairy hawk knights, who answered Merlin's request in this matter. Their children of gross couplings were given dower as might befit the children of a knight, and were fostered far away. By the time all this had occurred, Sherlock had been 3 years to Jean firmly bonded. Now, somewhat to his dismay, he'd been forced to treat with his family when his betrothal was celebrated. High King Arthur himself had gone to negotiate Sherlock's dower settlement with his vassal, the King of Logris. With him went his dear friend Merlin. The King of Logris was in a choleric temper, and made several unwise remarks upon the nature of Omega men. This was against all advice by Mycroft, who was visiting from Rome, where he'd been but lately made the heir to Caesar in the West, by the way of bonding to Caesar's only child, Olive, and the King of the Ostrogoths besides. Now, Sherlock was not there, but John asked Sir Gawain to describe it many times, how Merlin cracked the end of his staff upon the ground, and lightning crackled, and he'd remonstrated the king at length for repeating a spiteful rumor that his own wife had coined, and which had never been said until she said it, which was why Omegas curse her name and would never speak it again. Here you know the truth of this, for her name's not been mentioned in this story, nor ever shall it be. Nor by extension her bonded, who had good reason to know that it was not true, and yet acted as if it was. The King of Logris was much chastened, and he and his 6 sons journeyed to Camelot for the signing of Sherlock's betrothal, although it was Mycroft who did the actual signing of it. So it was that Sherlock was forced to speak with his father, the king, with some sort of a civil tongue, and each of his brothers in turn. He found that they were strangers, and he to them. The only one he knew at all was Mycroft, to whom he was quite loudly not speaking. Still, he quite enjoyed watching Jean join forces with Countess Silence at the tourney in Sherlock's honor. In the melee, they soundly trounced Granud, Sinead Moore, and Sir Assure, despite their previous boasting. As Countess Silence never boasted, she merely raised her brows at Jean,
and saw to it they took all three hostage in the field. It required a heavy ransom as their forfeit. Certus Claustrum and Magna Clavis were too deep in their cups to take part. By some strange circumstance, after an attempted trifling with the honor of the Lady Marys, blonde, brown, and red, woke the morning painted like jades, with their staffs also painted blue, and quite exposed upon the chapel altar. This was quite curious, for they were too heavy for the Lady Marys to have carried them. Although Sherlock quickly divined the truth by seeing a feather floating in the air above them, and chancing Merlin's expression. Now Mycroft, though his knights stood grimly by, and he'd no skill at all with jousting, most pleasantly asked Jean if he would care to face him three rounds in the lists. Jean quite agreed, and toppled him from his horse three times. As he'd so soundly lost, Mycroft then gave Jean a manor house with a fine garden, stocked with rare herbs, and a rich library as a forfeit. Sherlock did not particularly want this manor house, but he rather wanted the garden and the library. He was reading the list of books upon its shelves when John smiled and said, "I accept your forfeit." With that, little more was said of the matter, and Sherlock agreed to exchange some words with Mycroft for the remainder of the festivities, most of which were commentary on their other siblings. It was with some relief that the court of Logris and the Ostrogoths withdrew. The bonding, when it finally occurred, was much more to Sherlock's liking. He was even, to his great pleasure, able to name a position of love, as they completed the ceremonies that the court and the world required to name them bonded, and that their first bonded coupling was complete. Sherlock went to stand in the window of their chamber that opened out onto great Camelot in the city it justly guarded. He bent in the window and presented his nether cheeks, which were well watered with his prima materia, and said, "When we were unbonded, this position was called ruin. Now bonded as we are, and so transmuted, what is this position called?" As Jean thrust in, he said, "You may name it. As bonded by custom, do not stand as we now do." This pleased Sherlock greatly, as his cries and aspect gave witness to all who chanced to look up. This is why this position of love is now called locked in mystery. For all, it is more often called ruin. Now, as the years passed in John's company, and their family expanded, Sherlock went from revelation to revelation. When he'd been locked in the tower, he'd thought that he'd been well satisfied to be alone and focused on mystery. When he and Jean had first traveled upon the road through the forest, he'd often thought that as long as it were just they two, and with mysteries to solve, he'd be content. When he'd first come to himself, delivered of Kit, he'd been sure that if they could just regain their shapes, he'd be happy to shelter alone in the forest with just the two of them. His world had so far expanded beyond this, he could hardly name all of those who were in it. To list a few outside of their growing brood, there was the Countess Silence and her good friend, the Lady Lunette, who were always ready for adventure. Mistress Hudson, who was such an able chatelaine that Sherlock never lacked for anything. Billy and his child, who are much astonished to be given the slightest courtesy. The villain Omegas, who found their place within their household. Merlin, whose skill with magic was like breathing, but with little science, which made for heated discussion. Even, Sherlock had to admit, exchanging letters full of unasked for advice with Mycroft. Then there were the mysteries that all these people made to Sherlock available. For Sherlock was full of the sin of Eve. He had much curiosity, and was so greatly gladdened by secrets that could be opened up to truth. Yet with the hand of Holy Sophia lifting the veils from his mind, that he might light truth in the world, Sherlock could not much see that this was much of a sin, and he had always held that knowledge was good. Sherlock mused, when a sanguine humor was upon him, that it was as if Jean's staff were the anima mundi, the matter that made the world. and Sherlock's channel were the Omnia Mundi, the Heaven Road, and by their combination of their prima materia, between them they carried out internal alchemy that by its application made them both the better for it, and expanded the world in which they lived. So it was that Sherlock took as his crest the Philosopher's Stone, overset with the Tree of Knowledge, rich with apples, each with a bite taken out, and as his motto, Gero Valde Fructos, for he was much educated in philosophy. How it was that years later Kit, now a knight upon the road, chanced to become Sir Buck's boon companion, fell into rude coupling with the Lady Pigs, and on seeing the Lady Wolf, even though they were both alphas, and with nature and nurture looking on, exchanged the bites of bonding with her, is another story. It will not be related here, as this tale is done.